Hey, Rob.
Hi.
You wear a lot of fright rags.
I do.
So do I.
For me.
I have a drawer. I have a special drawer in my room that is all fright rags.
I have fright rag socks.
I have.
See, that's the thing. I have not delved outside the t-shirts and the baseball tees. Love the baseball tees. But you are a madman.
You went for the
socks, though. You love the socks.
Yeah. The socks are great.
If you guys haven't guessed already, our episode is brought to you by Fright Rags. Right now we have a discount code. So if you go to Fright Rags, you can type in Shockwaves 0817. Again, that's Shockwaves 0817 and use it to get a discount at our friends at Fright Rags.
They are focused on creating original artwork commissioned from top artists, and they have the highest quality printing on super soft ring spun cotton shirts. And I will say that is completely true because I'm really picky about my t-shirts. And I always say, like, man, I wish this was Fright Rags.
I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, guys. I love this company. But I really wish they had an Evil Dead 2 design.
Yeah.
Hey,
well, guess what?
Elric.
Guess what, Elric?
Oh. They've got one coming out celebrating the 30th anniversary of Evil Dead 2. It is coming August 23rd.
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
And
I think they just
dropped an E.T. collection.
They did.
I am due to get that Dawn of the Dead. They dropped a whole Dawn of the Dead collection.
Yes.
There was some artwork I had never seen before, but it was on a baby blue ringer tee.
Ooh.
I haven't worn ringer tees since I was in summer camp. So
you
I'm
need one.
Bust one out.
I was excited because I posted up about the Wraith or the Wrath. I don't even know.
The Wraith.
Okay, the Wraith. It is the Wraith, which I'll be talking about tonight. But as soon as I posted it, somebody linked to the Fright Rags tee underneath, and they have the Wraith t-shirt.
Oh, yeah.
I think they just did some RoboCop stuff, too.
They did.
So, man.
Yeah. Yeah. What I like, and I was trying to see if I can do this for Slashback, was the masks. They do, like, masks.
The Vancouver masks.
The Vancouver masks.
I just
so
did
great.
The Ben Cooper panel at Midsummer Scream last weekend, and some of the people had some of the Fright Rags masks there, and they are awesome looking.
And they're one of your sponsors for Slashback Video.
They are. Well, at Slashback Video, we're going to be doing a two for art show at the Mystic Museum in Burbank. So it's going to be part Ben Cooper art show and Slashback Video.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us. That was our show for today.
Welcome back, wise ass.
Yeah.
Hey.
This is episode 60. Yeah, we miss you, Elric. Where have you been?
A better replacement.
You've been traveling all over the place.
The show was really classy without you.
I imagine that guy was even more of a smartass than me.
Rob Schraub? Yeah. He was. There was a level of smartassness.
Good. I'm glad that.
He was cool, though.
We missed you. Yeah, cool. Rob Schraub was great, but we missed you.
We got up on stage at Midsummer Scream, and they threw eggs and lettuce and tomatoes at us. And they were like, not until Elric comes back. They're not going to listen. We managed to talk them down.
No cane,
they
no
ran
show.
Out of groceries to throw at us.
Actually, then, true story, a student texts me. He goes, oh, I happened to be at this Midsummer, and I just saw Shockwaves is going to be there. And I was like, oh, man. The one time I'm not there, and I said, just go up to them and say, pretend you don't know me, and just be like, this show's bullshit without Elric. But I don't know if he did
he
it.
He did
but.
Not.
That must have been.
It was a plant.
I did notice about 15 minutes into the show that a couple got up and walked out.
Yep.
So to you guys, I'm sorry.
They were offended by sharks.
I think we were only going through the introductions.
I know.
Like, nope.
They're key club friends.
Like they were suddenly like, oh man, they're mentioning Megalodon or Shark Attack Megalodon 3. We are so freaking
this is
out.
Too much.
They
can't even do intros. We're out of here.
So last week at Midsummer Scream, we kicked off Exploitation Month with Sharksploitation, which is very exciting. And we are going to do another topic for this episode, carrying on with that theme. It's gonna get a little heavy, I think.
A little heavy.
And
you never know. you never know how that topic's going to shake out.
All right. But we have a very special guest in the room with us to join us for this topic.
Yep.
A wonderful writer and friend to the horror community, BJ Colangelo.
Hi.
BJ.
Holy smokes. You exist.
I do. I'm a real
I met
person.
You once before, but now all of us
I'm
are
a real person.
You.
I'm not just a person on the internet who's moderating your Facebook group and telling people to chill out all the time.
We love that, though.
I also like your pin. You got a Phantom of the Paradise pin.
Yeah,
flip it up.
When you flip it up, you can see Winslow's gross face.
Wow.
And gross
big fan of Phantom of the Opera.
That's pretty
Phantom
cool.
Of the Paradise.
And so, but we're going to do our usual spiel, which is talk about what we've seen this week. And obviously, if there's some stuff that you want to chime in and tell us about that you've seen recently, that'd be great. But, you know, obviously, you've been writing for several years. But the main reason I thought this topic would be perfect for you is because, well, A, we've never talked about it. And B, the way that you kind of started in the horror writing world is by creating a blog called Day of the Woman, which, as most people know, is the original title of I Spit on Your Grave. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm one of the few people that'll tackle the topic and tackle it objectively because it is such a divisive topic. And there's a lot of strong opinions on both sides, understandably. And I like to analyze both sides as to why people think that way. And I find those films to be, you know, triggering for some, therapeutic for others. And I think that's why they're so fascinating. Yeah. And I don't want to say that I like the topic of rape revenge films, but I'm fascinated by it endlessly. And I think that they are an extremely valid form of cinema that people need to talk about more often.
And I think it's something that's coming back as well that I'm noticing on the film festival circuit. There are a lot of films that are making their way back. I think during the 70s, 60s, 70s, early 80s, we saw a glut of these types of films. And I think in the wake of so many horrifying headlines like campus rape and so on, these films are, you know, any good filmmaker is going to react angrily to things like that and do so through, you know, sometimes cinema. So now we're starting to see a lot of filmmakers approach it, you know.
But I'm seeing it in a different term now, because in the 70s, it was much more of like an exploitation, like quick kind of means to get there. But I think now we're seeing it approached on almost like an art film level. Where it's definitely being approached a little bit differently.
Yeah.
But we can get into
that.
We'll delve in. But so, Elric, you haven't been with us for a while, so why don't you kick us off?
Well, we did go to – we went to New York for a few days, and I'll start with that one because it's kind of fun. We got to talk to – one of the reasons I am on this podcast is because I discovered a book when I was about 17 years old called Cult Movies by Danny Perry. It's the thing that bonded me with Brian to even do the show Pure Cinema. So he's been working on this doc for years, but he hadn't interviewed Danny Perry. So I kept kind of harassing him going, you don't have a film until you get Danny Perry. So we, you know, we went there and I got to shoot it for him, and he interviewed Danny Perry. And we spent 2 days with this guy who is a very innocuous guy. He's not a guy who wants to be famous. He's not a guy who anyone could probably even recognize. But we got to spend 2 hours basically like worshiping at the altar. So he felt like his books had changed people's lives. It was pretty cool. But what was funny is the first thing he kind of said is, oh, I don't really think about movies as much as I used to. I guess I can't – that part of my brain after doing thousands of movie reviews. And we said, oh, that's a bummer. And then, of course, we spent 2 days talking about nothing but movies. And the best part, he's even crazier than us. He will just go – after a long day of doing whatever he does, he will go home and he'll just randomly pick a horror film on Netflix to watch without even researching it.
Oh, wow.
He will watch it all the way through. And I'm like, I'm not even that brave. And so the first thing out of his mouth was like, there was one. He was after going, well, I don't really watch movies anymore. He goes, oh, last week I saw something called Here Alone. It's on Netflix. I go, I haven't even heard of this thing. So I like start researching, but I saved it and stuff. So I actually did watch that last night just because I wanted to honor
Here Alone.
Here Alone. It's the director who did the Amanda Knox documentary, which is big on Netflix right now. It's a really interesting look at, you know, the crimes that she was not guilty of in the end, I guess, according to the doc. Anyway, it's kind of a post-apocalypse. I mean, I guess a lot like the Krisha director's film this year. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of similarities to that. It's very beautifully shot, but it's a little – the actual story is just so safe. It's post-apocalyptic. One woman survivor. She was a mom.
Mm-hmm.
And then it keeps flashing back to her life. It's like The Battery but without the fun.
Yeah.
And so
– It's a downer.
But the one thing I would say about it, good calling card for the director because it's a really beautifully put together movie. The guy knows how to make a movie. It's just that we've seen that story now, you know, today. So anyway – Danny, you know, thanks for that one, but, you know, I'll pass, but I love everything else.
Here Alone.
Here Alone is the name
here
of that
alone.
One.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Should I throw a couple others? Probably because I've seen more.
Yeah, do it.
And I'll do some of these quick. I saw Planet of the Vampires for the first time on the beautiful DCP, so the Mario Bava tour is here. It's going to be in L.A. In a week or so, all about 8 or 11 of his films, I think. The only one I got to go see in New York was Planet of the Vampires, a DCP. Gorgeous. I'd never seen this one of Bava's films before. I think it's definitely – people always talk about how Alien was ripping off this. I would say no. It's Prometheus that is ripping this.
It is mostly Prometheus that's ripping off Planet of the Vampires. Yeah. It's – it, the Terror from Beyond Space that everybody goes to for Alien.
But people always did say that for Alien. Yeah. But when I watch them, like, I don't know, costumes of Prometheus, lighting setup of Prometheus. Yeah. I didn't love this movie. I got to be honest. I love Bava. But for me, this was a little too much like old Star Trek, but with some really cool moody
lighting. I really like this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I believe that.
Yeah.
that makes total sense.
Thanks, Alric. No, I've always really liked this one. I thought it was something fun. It was a little bit different from kind of what Bava, it didn't feel as Bava as
Bava.
Yeah.
I mean, the lighting and everything's the same. It still looks gorgeous. Mm-hmm. It just, for me, I'm like, eh, no, I take Whip in the Body, you know? But anyways, cool. And then I saw the big one that I wanted to fulfill, the prophecy of Ryan. Oh, and then Becca later, but Ryan nailed it right as he sort of, as I got to see The Untamed.
Oh, nice. Oh.
So you guys have already heard them talk about it a bit as the possession-like film. The director, I didn't realize, was somebody whose other films I'd seen, Matt Escalante. He made a film called Healy, but a one that could be interesting to you guys called Los Bastardos, which is a really intense.
Really disturbing.
Yeah, disturbing. Two brothers, a lot of guns, rape. There's all sorts of very disturbing stuff.
It's like a gangster film, but it's seriously, or I guess it's supposed to be like a low-level gangster film, but it's like the most disturbing drug cartel film you could ever imagine.
And it makes a lot of border work, like stuff about both sides of the border. He's actually a Spanish director making films in Mexico. Mm. But anyway, this film, so I agree with everything they said. I'd say, funnily enough, the thing that I liked least about it, which will make no sense to anyone, is that it's the scenes with the alien and the creature are too much like Possession. It's almost the exact same thing, except they upped the level and made this an amazing looking thing that just blew my mind. I was like, how the fuck?
He's not even in the shadow. Like in Possession, it's like lurking over in the corner. And this, it's like, he's like, hey, what's up? I'm here. No, I'm up on the rafters.
It's pretty remarkable, but they're using it in such a similar way that you can't help but going, it's just a little too close. But that said, the overall idea of this movie of unfulfilled people being fulfilled by this thing is really great. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting, it's not even really hard. Most of it would just be a straight
drama.
Art house.
Yeah. Dark. It's an art house drama that happens to have a sex alien.
Yeah. And it's, but when it delivers, it's really cool.
Sex tentacle alien. Yeah.
And I think it's important because this to me is a big screen movie. I think at home it would be way easier to tune out. I think when you have to take it, especially some of the dark stuff. Really?
I watched it at home.
You watch everything at home.
I don't. but I did watch this one at home because somebody had sent me a screening link and it played perfectly fine on my television.
Okay. Well, I want to see it on picture.
Yeah. I know in LA, I think it's playing at the Cinefamily.
That's what I'm saying. It's about to come.
And I saw the trailer there on the big screen.
Oh, cool.
I was pretty blind. I didn't know what it was at all. Even from your descriptions, I didn't place it until the title came up. So
for me,
I'm
going
to try to catch it there.
Where the other film we keep dissing today, I'm not doing this on our other post-horror movie by the creature director. Why can't I? It comes at night. I can't remember it because the ending was so unfulfilling to me. But this movie, I'm sorry, this movie has so many of the same aesthetic things that's going for, which is like, you know, a shot on trees that slowly zooms in while sound design's working. But in this movie, the sound design pulls me in and I actually feel like I did get something out of that, not just an emptiness.
That was one of the really interesting things I noticed in The Untamed, where there was one part where they were literally zooming in on, I want to say it was a cliff face.
Uh-huh.
And while it was zooming in, I was like, that cliff looks like a vagina. And like you start seeing these things in it that I never would have seen.
I look at most cliffs that way.
That cliff looks like a vagina.
And then I climb it. Then I climb those cliffs.
Well done.
Anyway, so I highly recommend it. It's definitely going to be one of my favorite movies of the year. It's fun. Maybe if I see it again, the possession shock of it being so similar in that way. If you haven't seen it, I bet this would be just the coolest thing ever.
Yeah. Cool. The Untamed.
Vagina Cliff.
Untamed.
Cool.
I'll wait on that.
Excellent. So as I mentioned earlier, I noticed that Charlie Sheen's The Wraith was playing on Netflix, and I had not seen it since the 80s. So I was like, I should revisit this.
The original Crow.
Yes, I was going to say it is the ultimate Crow, which is a rape revenge film, but this is not. So I'll talk about why I think the Crow is later.
I agree with you.
The Wraith, Charlie Sheen. Had I not known the backstory of Charlie Sheen kind of left midway through shooting to go make Platoon and they had to get somebody else
I didn't know
all
that
these
either.
Years, I never knew that.
Yeah, Charlie Sheen, that's why there's like multiple actors and there's times where like even after he becomes Charlie Sheen, where he'll be like in profile and you'll be like, that's clearly not Charlie Sheen.
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm gonna
rewatch it.
Yeah.
Rewatch it now. It gets rather confusing because even there are points where he gets out of the car and you know it's supposed to be Charlie Sheen, but it's a completely different actor and you're like, this is bizarre.
And there's scenes where the night school person is just walking in playing the same character. I'm sorry.
So
not deep
Sheen,
enough night school. Okay.
got the offer to do Platoon midway through making The Wraith and was like, see you guys, I'm out of here, Oliver Stone and stuff. And interestingly enough, apparently at the time when they were making this, the female lead is Sherilyn Fenn. And at the time she was dating Johnny Depp. Supposedly, Johnny Depp was offered the role, was offered Charlie Sheen's role. Somehow it went to Sheen, who then turned it down, but then Depp also got a role in Platoon. But apparently Depp was on time, was on set for the entire thing because he was actually staying with Sherilyn Fenn while they were shooting this thing in Arizona. But none of this even remotely compares to Clint Howard in the movie.
Oh, yeah. No, Clint's amazing.
So Clint Howard is literally, he just plays like the weird mechanic, but he's got this like eraser heads type
crazy
hair.
Yeah.
And he's got these like Coke bottle glasses, and all he does is show up and be like, okay, we're racing for pink slips. And he's like really intense. And it's crazy.
It's the original Fast and Furious.
Yeah. And I have, like, the plot of this movie is a little confusing. So the guy gets killed by this gang, this car gang. And so fate or Jesus or somebody in the afterlife gives him both this crazy fast car, a crazy cool leather outfit, and a motorbike so that he can, you know, not have to drive the car everywhere. And then sends him back into the town to take revenge on Nick Cassavetes, who plays the swarthy biker or car gang dude. So the plot in general is a little kind of, you know, it's a little off. But this movie has the most amazing soundtrack ever, like way better than it deserves to have, like Ozzy and just all types of crazy metal
rocking
bands. It's an amazing
thing. I loved that movie when I started as a kid. I haven't seen it since.
I started watching it when it hit Amazon Prime about a month ago. And then about 20 minutes in, I was like, wow, everybody's really misogynistic. And
Ozzy's
like
Nick Cassavetes is rapey and the whole time.
Like, holy crap, I'll finish this later. And then I never got a chance to finish it.
And what's crazy
never got to the Wraith.
I think they're supposed to be high school students, but they never actually go to high school. Like, they all carry around backpacks, and you kind of get the idea that they might be in high school.
But no
one ever goes to high school. Like, there's one point where they're all walking with backpacks, and then they go to this stream that apparently they all hang out at. It is literally like a stream,
you
and they're there
stream?
Like at the beach.
I have a stream.
It's in Arizona. I guess they just had a stream. So they're all like there in their bathing suits, and it's literally a stream. So I'm not sure if they're high school students or not. I don't know what the hell they are. They like cars. They're
community
like,
college, probably.
Community college.
Hanging out.
I'm going to rewatch
it. It's
the
really
Wraith.
Fun. The soundtrack.
When
is
was the last
epic.
Time you saw it?
You know what? I didn't even watch the whole thing. I actually worked on the DVD, whatever the last release of it was. I interviewed like the stunt guy from it, which was pretty awesome.
Apparently, there was actually a death on the set.
Yeah, and that's what we had to skate around. I could flat out ask about it, but we did. He did talk about.
Yeah, it was the second AD. It was one of the car maneuvers. The second AD, something happened in one of the car maneuvers on set.
Did he get hit by the car? Was he in the car?
I'm not sure on that. Jeez. The film is actually dedicated to him at the very beginning. That's what I researched. Is at the very beginning, it came up and said like dedicated to, and I was like, who got the Wraith dedicated to them? And then I researched it. Still, a very fascinating movie, very, very 1980s and amazing soundtrack.
It was awesome at 12, but I don't know about now.
Clint Howard still kicks ass.
All right, Ryan, what'd you see?
I caught up to Elric on this one. I finally watched Madhouse, which is now available on Arrow Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Thoroughly enjoyed this film.
Wasn't a nice surprise.
Just to recap, it's about a woman who discovers that her twin sister, who has been hospitalized for a long time and is I don't know if you mentioned this last time, but she's suffering from a virus that is basically eroding her flesh. And like making her deformed.
I never understood what it was from.
Like she had like a form of Ebola something.
Was that even around then? Mad cow is not flesh. Yeah. Neither's Ebola, guys. Yeah. Neither of these two were.
So very
necrotizing
weird.
I told you we shouldn't do a show with a PhD person.
Well, that might actually be it.
Necrotizing facilitis is flesh-eating disease.
Okay, so I think that's what she has.
Or it could be leprosy. I mean, just good old leprosy.
It's a form of something. But anyways, the twin doesn't look like a twin anymore. And she's obviously harboring a lot of ill will towards her sis, and she's always been a little warped, and she's finally like let free. And meanwhile, the good sister is spending predominantly like 90 minutes of the runtime thinking that her life is in danger. No one's really listening to her. Meanwhile, everybody's dying around her by dog attacks, weird other deaths, and so on. Meanwhile, she's got this really creepy pastor who was like, oh, don't worry, it's okay, your sister. And you're like, dude, bro, you're in on this shit. Like, there's something, you can see it a mile away. But the deaths, the atmosphere. Like, I got sucked into
and
this.
And some
kind of
fun turns towards the end. Like, where you're like, oh,
really
okay,
fun turns.
Fun,
they don't make much sense logistically. No. I had to go back and, literally.
Look who directed it, dude. That's the guy who made The Visitor. It's like,
I had to do a 5-minute rewind. Not a 30-second rewind, but a 5-minute rewind to go, wait a second. Let me just pick up when literally someone goes, this is why. And I was like, oh, great. But at the end of this is why, I still didn't have any new knowledge. Like, I gained nothing new. If you want something, it kind of reminded me of like a fucked up made for TV movie.
Yeah, yeah, totally. You know? What about that Rizzo Ohlani score? It's pretty nice.
Oh, yeah, the score is good.
Kind of
yeah.
a little Holocaust in there.
A little over the top. Yeah. It's a little over the top, but it's pretty awesome. Yeah.
I haven't seen this one since I was a kid, but all I remember is it's a slasher, but it's the dog.
It's a slasher, that's all but I there's remember. A dog, but there's some great slasher movie moments when the sis pops up. There's a beat when the building handyman's going down into the basement and she attacks him, and the way the scare gag occurs, the way it was orchestrated, like, made me jump. I was like, oh shit, I didn't expect that. And then there's kind of like this weird haunting lasting quality that happens after, because you're not sure what you just saw. When it comes to like her face, because they're hiding the sister's face the entire time.
It's like all Italian films, all great Italian horror, where most of it doesn't make a lick of sense, but the atmospheric parts are better than most American horror films.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't trade it.
I also love that they injected this kind of element where she's teaching deaf kids how to sign language. But I mean, like, it's a through theme, because one of the children is put in peril, and you're like, oh my god, are they going to go there?
Yeah.
But it's really cool.
And the dog effects are all perfect, right?
Oh god. the thing that bummed me out is they did a dog attack repeat, and I was like, oh man, I just saw this, but no, here they tried out the old puppet, and she's like, no, not my throat.
It's the same puppet for Conan O'Brien usually uses with the song. It's pretty amazing.
But in terms of a blind buy, I was satisfied. I just bought it sight unseen. I liked the cover. I was like, oh, this, I think I saw, Italian, set in New Orleans or Savannah. And I was like, oh, I love Italian movies set in old in the South. All right, great, let's do it. So yeah, that was
same town
Mad
city
House.
Of what's Fulci's City of the Dead.
City of the Living Dead.
Yeah, same city that was shot there.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Good stuff.
Madhouse.
BJ.
Yay. Seen recently you'd like to throw out there?
Yeah. So I've been in production on my first feature, so I've been missing everything. I've been
that
just
happens.
Kind of in
congrats.
A, thanks. Yeah. I've been under a rock, but I did have two, technically three, but the first one is I fell headfirst into the web series Dragula by the Boulay brothers. It is RuPaul's Drag Race mixed with Face Off. Wow. So it is a bunch of drag queens competing to be America's top drag super monster. So everything is horror related. So it's a combination of special effects, but drag queens.
Oh my gosh, where can we find this?
It's on YouTube or heyqueen.tv. Queen, I think, is like Q-W-E-E-N.
Yeah.
But they just started casting for their second season. So I was like, you know what? I got to catch up on this. But the first episode is who's the baddest bitch of them all? And it's a interpretation of the Wicked Witch challenge. So it's all of these drag queens having to do their own interpretation of the Wicked Witch of the West. And some of them do like very voodoo tribal witches. Some of them do like one is like covered in candy and she's the witch from, you know, Hansel and Gretel. So it's like a really fucked up bloody candy witch.
Ooh, I could see that as a movie character. Like
it's
Hansel and
really
Gretel,
fascinating.
Candy witch. I like it.
But then they'll make them do actual horror challenges where they'll like one of them, they buried them alive under like in a coffin and then bury them and like saw who could stay down there the longest without freaking out.
So it's got like fear factor.
They're throwing a lot at the wall with it, but it's really entertaining. And if people like effects or makeup, definitely check it out. And of course, if you like drag queens and kind of the theatrics and drama that go with that, it's perfect.
Dragula.
It looks like it debuted last Halloween, 2016. So
So the first season, they're all on YouTube. You can check all of them out. But
that sounds like a blast.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And then the other thing that I did is there is a local drive-in by where I live in Cleveland, the Autorama Drive-In. And every Tuesday in the summer, they do a retro night. And it's usually a double feature that somewhat has something to do with each other. Mm-hmm. Like this year for the 25th, they do Christmas in July. So it'll be Elf and It's a Wonderful Life. But they'll do two horror Once each summer, and the first one was Child's Play in Motel Hell.
Nice.
It wow. was
two of my killer. Faves.
So it's, you know, it's a Tuesday night. It's doesn't get dark until, you know, 9:30 or so. So you're staying out pretty late on a school night. But watching Child's Play on the big screen is something I've never done because I'm a small child, and it was out long before I was alive. And seeing it at the drive-in was fantastic. I mean, it's a Chicago horror movie, and that's where I'm from originally. So I love it. I love seeing everything. I love being able to be the asshole that can point and be like, oh my God, I've been there. I live there kind of thing. plus Chris Rand on a big screen is always a good thing too. But watching other cars watch was probably the most fun because a lot of teenagers go to this. And I think for a lot of them, it was their first time ever seeing it. I think that they know Chucky as a character, but they don't actually right. know the film.
Where it came yeah. from.
Yeah. And right. that first one's scary, unlike right. the other one. Yeah. So,
and I forgot how great Andy is in that movie. Like, he's one of the best, like, toddler mm-hmm. yeah. children. He's so endearing and cute, and I just want to grab
survivor.
Him.
And he's yeah. a survivor. He walks through, like, Chicago streets. There's when he goes into the kind of projects.
Right. And then, he's like and taking just a piss on the side by
it's
himself.
It's a wide like, shot, and it's just dead? This little kid walking through the projects, and you're like, oh my God, get out of there, Andy.
Yeah, I mean, he's walking through like Candyman territory at one point.
Oh my God, BJ.
You have linked the universes.
Yeah. Oh,
maybe he goes through Cabrini universe. Green.
Right? Yeah.
What if Andy's trapped in like the giant trash heap right now?
Yeah. Oh, oh my gosh.
Burning with
Andy
Virginia
walked
Madsen.
Through that giant face hole in the wall. And he has entered into Candyland. Right there.
What if Andy was in the bathroom stall when Virginia Madsen went in to look for Candyman the first time and those guys jumped her? And he was just sitting there going,
the camera just
oh my
turned.
God.
Andy's there.
He's like witness. What happened? The witness kid. Yeah.
He went from the doll to this. Like, this kid just, he's wandering through every horror film. And then he goes into the Poltergeist 3 building. And
oh,
then
yeah.
it's just all oh, nice. Yeah.
Look at this.
Shared and then universe. Andy's adventures. Lucas drives by and kills everyone in the
Sorry, we derailed that.
No, you're fine. And then Motel Hell on the big screen was an experience because I forget how like I forgot how disgusting the guttural sound is of all the heads.
Oh, yeah.
So hearing that like echoing oh, yeah. in a car
yeah.
while watching it was like it got so grating at some point where like my skin was crawling because yeah. it's just oh,
it is pretty
was there yeah. was there a connection between the two or just cause I'm trying to think
whoever,
I never would have thought of that double
it's
bill.
Either whoever it's distributed both
oh,
of them
MGM.
Like yeah
no. it's an MGM double bill.
So okay. they did that but the final one of the season is Silver Bullet and Maximum Overdrive
nice.
And I will 1000% be
oh,
there because that's going to be a blast
damn.
And a half and then they also do it's a quadruple feature for $10 around Halloween and last year it was like Nightmare 1, Nightmare 2, Creepshow, and Killer Clowns from Outer Space. Like, it's always something, one is ridiculous and the rest kind of makes sense, but they do, like, this huge blowout at the drive-in for Halloween. Like, kids go trunk-or-treating and get candy. There's costume contests. Like, it's a whole thing.
Trunk-or-treating?
Yeah.
Trunk-or-treating. Did you never do that?
And the
one,
is adorable.
One screen will be the scaries.
I don't understand. What is
it? You literally put up the trunks
trunk
of your cars and then the kids go around trick-or-treating to the cars and you pass out candy.
Yeah.
A lot of churches used to do it in my hometown because it was like, we don't want our kids, like, going out to door-to-door because, you know, it was the 80s and there were Satanists everywhere.
Yeah.
And so you have them do it in the church parking lot with the trunks. And so we used to do it. There was a couple of places in my town that did it, I remember. And I would always, my parents would go to the trunk or treat, but then we would also go out trick-or-treating because my parents didn't mind Satanists. So.
Yeah, double candy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always really nice. Like, there's the one screen for adults doing all horror, and then there'll be another screen at the same time for children, and it'll be like Ghostbusters and Beetlejuice and the Addams Family and things that are more family friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really cool because like my hometown and out in Chicago, they just shut down that drive-in. So like we're losing them every day. And the fact that there's one so close to me that's still open, like I try to go as much as possible because, you know, a couple tickets could be life or death for their entire theater.
I took, because I grew up in a town that has a drive-in. It's still there, the Starlight Drive-In in Winchester, Virginia, or actually Stephen City because it's just outside. And I, for the longest time, it was the only theater that we had in the town when I was growing up. Like, I remember when they built the indoor theater. Prior to that, if you wanted to sit inside to see a show, you had to drive into, like, the D.C. area. Like, it that was, like, you did that on your birthday. It was getting fancy. Like, I remember seeing the Jetsons movie at an indoor theater, and it was, like, a big deal. But yeah, so growing up with a drive-in now, every single time I go home, I take my kids.
My first drive-in experience was watching Twister because, again, I'm a child. But like, just think about Twister for a second because they have the scene in the drive-in. So I was probably like six and I'm watching it and I recognize The Shining because I had neglectful parents that let me watch whatever I want. So I knew that and I was like, oh, cool, they're watching The Shining. And then the tornado hit and by some act of God, there was a thundercloud above our actual theater, and I lost my shit. So my first drive-in experience was traumatic.
Oh, wow.
That'd be a cool series, like all the films that have good drive-in horror scenes in it while you're at the drive-in. Yeah. Like, what's our favorite turkey film, Thanksgiving movie? The opening of that. Blood Rage.
Blood Rage?
Oh, Blood Rage. opening of Blood Rage is
Blumhouse's very own The Town of the Dreaded Sundown. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. But they actually use it.
It's a one-er.
Dead End Drive-In has some great stuff
there's
in there.
There's so many. It'd be great.
Let's put a list together for a future episode.
Yes. We should actually make that an episode. It should be drive-ins.
I've actually never been to a drive-in.
There's still two active ones out here.
There's a really good one over in City of Industry called the Tiki Drive-In.
No, that City of Industry is a different one, and the Tiki's on the other side. But the problem is they don't do what you're talking about. They're just new films, straight up.
And
it's always kind of like, it's good, but if it's like for people with kids, it makes sense. But anyone else, it's not that fun.
And actually, it was because of Elric that I went to those, because right after I gave birth to Marnie, I remember lamenting to immediately. I'm like, I need to go to a movie. No, I remember the next week, World War Z had just come out, and I was lamenting to Elric. I was like, I really want to see this fucking movie, and I can't, like, because when you first have a kid, like, they scream every half an hour. If they do not eat, they are going to scream. And I was like, I can't do that in a theater. I can't take her to a theater. And Elric was like, go to the drive-in. That's what we did.
It did work.
And
cool.
So I'm in the drive-in with my little preemie kid watching the movie.
I know that it's like almost the end of the summer, but anybody finds out who owns that place,
let's do a hard thing.
Let me know.
Let's
try to find something so maybe Shockwaves can do a double bill there.
That would be amazing.
That'd be fun.
That's actually a great idea to host something there.
Sure.
You'll pull it in for sure.
The drive-in in my town used to do both. They would occasionally do like the horror double bills where like that's where I saw tons of Herschel Gordon Lewis stuff. That's how I've seen every Herschel Gordon Lewis film. But at the same time, I remember a lot of times you would like go to see whatever the new horror film was and then right after it, they would play Hope Floats. And then like you're trying to stomach the first 5 minutes of this Sandra Bullock abomination.
Junior, baby.
And then finally, you're like, okay, I can't do this.
But
and then
you leave. This is funny because it's not a side conversation, really, when you think about it, because this is exactly what exploitation movies were being made for.
Yeah,
they were being made for that screen, not theaters, you know?
Yeah.
It's a big difference of where you can stick something, you know?
Yeah.
But I have a couple more titles.
Yeah, no, me too. I'm just glad that it wasn't.
But it was a good topic, BJ. I love it.
Let me shoot a couple of quick ones out. I did a double bill this week, as mentioned from our Sharksploitation episode, of Jaws 3D and Bait 3D. I did invite Rob to join me, he was in the middle of shooting. Yes, he was shooting something, and I had two different sets of friends that had been asking me for Jaws 3D for a while now. So I was like, it's now or never. Summer's almost over. But I will show them to Rob at some point, I promise. They're kind of fun. I mean, Jaws 3D is not a good movie, but it is – everyone that saw it agreed that it was a much more entertaining movie in 3D, like in proper 3D. Doesn't have a whole lot of Jaws in it.
No.
And when you do see Jaws, I think it's the worst he looks in the entire franchise.
Oh, of course. I saw that terrible. Instagram photo you put up.
Oh, yeah.
The video.
It's great.
It reminded me of just how awful that CG.
But I do like Dennis Quaid and Leah Thompson, and it's got some fun stuff in it. And Bait 3D, as I mentioned last week, is I still like it. This may have been the first time that I was like, all right, maybe I don't like it as much as that last time I saw it. Maybe it's not as fun as I remember, but it's still pretty darn fun. So there's that, but the one I really want to talk about was I bought Code Red has been doing some pretty fascinating stuff as of late, and I picked up
Brûlé.
What?
Brûlé?
Brûlé.
That's what he says all on our episode. He goes, "Oh, it's coming to Brûlé. It's coming to Brûlé." So I just started saying brûlé instead of Blu-ray now. It's coming to brûlé.
Yes, I picked up a brûlé. It was freshly baked and came out of the oven. It's One Dark Night, which is Tom McLaughlin's first movie.
I just got
movie.
It too. I haven't watched it yet.
I need to get it.
Yeah, this came out in 1982, and Tom McLaughlin went on to direct Friday 13th 6, mm-hmm. Jason Lives, which is arguably one of the most fun of the Friday franchise. And you know what? I've seen this movie, but I did not remember a single thing about it. It was like watching it for the first time again. And it's okay for a debut feature. Meg Tilly's in it, as is E.G. Daly.
Where would you rank it with all the Phantasm films? Which one would you put it?
Oh, because of the mausoleum.
I just feel like the whole movie could literally have had a ball and it would have been a Phantasm film. It's not up there with number one by any means.
I didn't like it as much as those Phantasm movies. It, you know, it's a little, it was a little slow, but I liked, and everybody's like, kind of like very dramatic, like Meg and her boyfriend and are kind of over.
And Adam West, some weird.
Adam West has got like a little bit part because it's connected to some psychic guy that died and like he's in this mausoleum. Basically, they dare Meg Tilly to sleep overnight in this mausoleum. And then all the girls that did it are like trying to play practical jokes on her. But it just so happens that the guy that they just put in there has some sort of magic ability or
well,
was
no, he was not
magic.
He was there's a form of psychic where he dealt with power and
yes.
and he has used that power to come back. I can't remember what
yeah.
it was.
I mean, I just watched it and even I didn't know what the hell was going on. So, but it's okay and it looks pretty decent on Blu-ray. I was talking to Joe Madry earlier today who wrote Tom McLaughlin's biography because I think when Tom was on our show on Killer POV, he mentioned that there was a different cut of this. Mm. So I was trying to figure out like what the hell version this is. I think there's only the theatrical cut, which looks pretty good on Blu-ray. I think that whatever that director's thing was is on a VHS somewhere or whatever. But anyways, One Dark Night from Code Red Blu-ray.
It's a fun one. I want to watch Blu-ray. It again.
Nice.
The new show by the Duplass brothers, I give it 2 snaps up in a circle. And that's
and he actually just did it.
It's on HBO. Hey, you know
which show?
This was before you existed. The show I'm referencing, just so you know, In Living Color. Duplass Brothers show. It's called Room 104. And a friend of mine is appears at some point in it. That's probably not even. It doesn't matter. I just said a friend.
Is Mark in it?
Somebody I know. Anyway, this show is the idea. The only connective tissue is that there's a room called Room 104 of a motel, and every single episode has a different director, I don't know if it's different writer and even totally different tones apparently, but the first one is pure Twilight Zone. Sarah Dina Smith from Midnight Swim directed the first one. I loved it. I thought it was super fun and I love that they're 26 minutes. I love that it's like a short form HBO. It's like cool to see because we are in a time now where form like length does not mean anything. Mm. Everything's being obliterated by all the different. So to have something on HBO that's like 25 minutes long is really exciting to me. And I've heard the next episode is like bonkersly different than this one. So I'm really excited about this show more just in the possibilities, not every episode necessarily being perfect. I could care less. I just want them to do something different. And I think the pitch for that show when they pitched it was just we have a room and the story changes every episode. And that was it.
That's so there's no plot. Through line. That's the setup of Inside Number 9. God damn it, no.
But no one's seen that except...
Seriously! That is the whole fucking thing of Inside Number 9.
But there's some connective tissue to that show, right?
No, none.
Nothing at all?
None. Okay. The only thing is that they are all number 9.
Who does
that
it better?
It.
Yeah, I haven't
Who
seen
Who wore
them.
It better?
They're British, so this is better.
Oh!
British are oppressors.
I'm telling you, there are people on the
UK
Shockwaves fan page who absolutely love Inside Number 9 with reason. It's fucking unbelievable, so...
Well, anyway,
I will
like
now
show.
Watch Room 104 and
Check
be the
out.
Judge.
Check it out. On our plane back, me and Brian, a couple days ago in the front seat was Mr. Dawson from Dawson Creek himself with a fat mustache.
James Vanderbeek.
It was pretty fat. Yeah. It was awesome. He looked like badass. He is in the next episode, so he's their lead. So I was like, oh, nice timing. I thought that show was cool. And just a couple of real quick ones. I had never seen the bar's name Phantom Carriage. I'd never seen the Phantom Carriage.
Oh, yeah.
Finally, okay, I recorded it a year and a half ago on TCM. It's just been sitting there. Mm-hmm. I watched it, and it's pretty good. And, I mean, it's got a great reputation. Victor Seastrom, who's made most of the best silent films, actually, a lot of them. But the one thing that was super – I was excited to tell people about here, besides the kind of double exposure photography where the thing looks super creepy, the specter who's coming, death, basically. But the cool thing in this is there is a scene – that is directly so clearly what The Shining ripped off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
When he's like taking the axe to the door, like to see it, because I'd never read that. I'm just watching, and then suddenly that happened. I was like, oh my God, it's literally just the scene from The Shining.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
This is 1918.
Yeah.
No, 1921. So, I mean, that's pretty rad.
There's a really nice Blu-ray of it. I think Criterion.
It's a Criterion. Yeah. It is a Criterion. It's just one of those ones I'd never watch, and I'm actually a really big silent film guy, so I was kind of surprised. It was fun. And the last thing, just so I can be done with these, because there's so many to catch up on, I finally saw Colossal by Nacho Vigalondo.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Oh, yeah.
I really loved the first half. And there was a character leap in this movie that completely took me out of this movie completely, where I was just like, nah, not interested. I think a lot of people are going to love it, so I'm not worried about it. Like, I'm not worried about me, because I still liked it a lot. And I love that Nacho, like, just took this huge risk on a movie that could totally not work. And Anne Hathaway was awesome in it. I thought she was really funny and really, you know, just great. But there was just some character stuff that was the kind of the point of the movie that, where I was just like, I don't know, for me. And I kind of came out of it at a certain point. But I think people—
Are you talking about the leap with the other character?
Yeah, the other character.
What are you talking about? Like, you would need runway for that. And I think they built that up really nicely.
I don't know, for whatever reason, I didn't like it. It just took me out of it. Like, I don't want to spoil it. So I don't want to. But everyone's good in it.
I mean, it's on the poster, so
it's fun, but it's not. I mean, I know there's a lot of people, it's hard, it's not hard. That conversation doesn't really matter. But what it really is, because it really doesn't ever, it's never scary, it's never a tonal horror. What it is really a superhero movie, in the same way that Split is kind of feels like that. It's similar in that way, even though Split's scarier in a sense. This is much more big robots in the Pacific Rim kind of way.
Yeah,
it's not, you know, in the horror that we would normally talk about.
It's so. It's a weird kaiju. Weird kaiju anti-romantic comedy.
Yeah, but still that's with comedy. With a lot of comedy. Yeah, it's a funny movie. But it's cool. And Nacho's a one of a kind. I mean, you look at his work and you go, okay, no one could hit these tones.
BJ, have you seen this? Mm-mm. No? You should see it.
It's on VOD now, right?
Yeah, that's why I started.
I've been waiting. Keep seeing everybody posting like boomerangs of the cover.
Monster? Oh, the banger.
Yeah.
That switches between Monster and Anne Hathaway.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. How did it do in theaters?
I think it didn't really connect. Yeah. Nothing. I mean, it only got released on
It's got cult written all over it. So that's the fun thing. Like, it'll have a life.
But I mean, in terms of Nacho's small body of work, I think it's one of his strong. Like, I think Time Crimes.
Time Crimes is a masterpiece.
Yeah, Time Crimes is amazing. But I would put this in the second.
Yeah. And then did you guys see Extraterrestrial?
Yeah. It didn't really work for me.
You should see Extraterrestrial. It's like a couple trapped in an apartment during an alien invasion.
No.
Yeah,
it's cool. I actually like his VHS. Is it two or three? His segment on that was like, I think it was the three, because of the one that I don't like VHS
Which
three
one
much.
Was his?
His the is one the one with the alternate dimension.
Oh, yeah.
And
that
I thought
was
that was brilliant. I was like, that
was
fun. You know, all the weird sex stuff.
Nice. So I saw, I'll do two more things. Being inspired by Ryan and the fact that Hello Mary Lou Prom Night 2 is on Amazon Prime. I rewatched this sucker last night. I had not seen this since 1986 or whenever it came out. And I had always had these really fond memories of it just being amazing and a lot of fun. And it did not disappoint.
Yeah. My heart actually stopped there for a second. I was going to go, Becca, this could be the end of the podcast.
No, seriously. And it's weird because I remember, even at the time, I was not a big fan of Prom Night 1. I'd always found it kind of a slog. Yeah. But I loved Prom Night 2. And I really like Prom Night 3 as well, which is kind of weird. A lot of people
don't like that one.
I'm telling you, Prom Night 3. Brennan's giving me thumbs up. Prom Night 3, it's meta and it's very self-aware, but there's some charm to
it. What's the subtitle for that one? Is it just Prom Night 3?
The Last Kiss.
Which one
is this the one with the dude on the motorcycle riding out of the
I'm telling you, it's meta. It's definitely kind of
when
self-aware
she says
of
meta,
what it is.
She's saying it's just really bad comedy. Like, because Mary Lou takes two ice cream cones at one point and stabs a dude through both his hands with them. With ice cream cones.
It's amusing.
Which one has the line where she goes, I don't get mad, I bake? I think that's
the third one.
Like, I probably have like a screenshot that I use all the time whenever people are like, you mad? And I'm like, I don't get mad, I bake. And I'm like, I don't have any idea what I'm talking about.
It's funny, it's self-aware, but I don't mind the third one. It's definitely not the second one. The second one's fucking brilliant.
So I think we're all unanimous on Prom Night 2.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, I have to.
Shockwave's approved.
Wow. Like,
and it wasn't made as a sequel. It was made as a totally separate
It was made as a film called The Horrors of Hamilton High or something about Hamilton High. And then it was actually the distributor that said, you have to call this a prom night sequel. It will help. And the producers actually got really angry at it and think that it actually hurt the success of the film to link it to the prom night franchise.
Well, what's funny, I just rewatched this. The Amazon Prime one is fine, but I have the DVD and the DVD's in widescreen. Yeah, so I watched a few minutes on Amazon.
Yeah, because the Amazon Prime's 4:3.
Wait a minute, I have this. I could just watch the regular. But what's funny about it is it totally feels like a Carrie sequel.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's prom night, but right away, in like, because the prom starts in 1957,
right.
They quote prom night.
Yep.
Which is what's this line that she says? It's not who you're with, it's who you go home with or something. Yeah. So I'm like, wait, that's right from prom night. Well, so there's the connection.
They quote everything. I mean, like all of the characters, like, oh, it's you, Professor Henenlotter, over here with Mrs. Carpenter and Mr. Craven are back with Principal Blank. It's like
no true-fledgling filmmakers don't do this.
Don't do that. You don't need to elbow us the whole time. Please never do that.
Fred Decker got away with it. All right, that's the only one I forgive.
So and Howling, Joe Dante's Howling has a lot of that.
You can get away with it in some of the final Destination films because they go at least a little bit more obscure. It's not
like Val Luton.
That one's pretty on the nose if you're aware of it, but that's not something that, like, my mom is going to know.
Yeah.
This was just a little over the top. Like, there's certain times that, like, when there's a kids movie, Hugo, or not Hugo.
Scorsese movie?
No. There's like a kids movie where they actually like reference Argento, or like in Monsters, where one of the bars that the monsters go to is named after a star.
Oh, it's
Harryhausen.
Yeah, Monsters Inc. is Harryhausen.
Yeah. So there's like certain times that I'm like, oh, that was cute. But that's about the best you're going to get from me is, oh, that was cute. And when it's every single freaking character, I was like, okay, that's a little bit much.
So many horror icons have such distinct names too. It's not like they're Smith. Like, you could get away with it if you were like Mr. Waters or Mr. Hughes, but the second you say Mr. Cronenberg, it's
Mr. Henenlotter, it's like, oh, okay. But that said, the movie's freaking unbelievable. The effects are great, and it had one of the best jump scares that, like, actually got me in a long time, where she's standing up at the top of the stairs and he's looking through the mirror, like a window of the door. The door has a window in it, and he's looking through it, and she's up at the top of the stairs, and then while she's still up at the top of the stairs, she appears right in front of him.
It's the shock from Shock. Same thing. I love that.
That's a little different, but it was really like, I was actually like, it got me.
And it has the great whiteboard, the chalkboard
effect
scene.
Was
just so
beautiful.
Surreal.
And Michael Ironside.
So definitely check out Hello Mary Lou Prom Night 2 while it is on Amazon Prime. And then the last one I will talk about is The Worst Witch TV Show, which is now on Netflix. And before you guys groan, just picture it as, for me as a female, this is pretty much, and I mean, I love Monster Squad too, obviously, but this is pretty much if they made Monster Squad a rebooted TV show. So I have to discuss it. Because The Worst Witch, if you were a female during the 80s, this was a huge freaking deal. It had Fairuza Balk in it. It had Tim Curry. This was like a massive thing. Did you see this one, BJ?
I haven't. It's on my list of things to catch up on.
Okay.
Wait, pre-craft Fairuza is in The Worst Witch?
Yeah, she's the little girl. She's the main character. She plays Mildred Hubble. Jenica's in the room as well. Worst Witch? Oh, she didn't like the original.
Oh,
it's also
like
got
Return to Oz.
I like the truth.
Return
like
to Oz for Fairuza Balk. It's also got Mrs. Garrett from Facts of Life plays the head mistress.
I'm in.
See, now I'm already, yeah.
So
I'm
that's
in.
The original.
That's
film.
Why you're in. Okay.
So this is the original film, and for me, growing up, like girls of the '80s under the age of 10, this was like horror light because it's pretty much Harry Potter, but it was darker than Harry Potter, and it was all about being a witch and fighting evil witches and things like that, and. So when I heard that they were rebooting it as a TV show, I was kind of like, okay, you know what? I'm in. It needs an update. The 80s movie feels 80s now. Tim Curry comes out with this giant cape and does this neon dance where like a bat like holographically forms above his head and shit. Whoa. Like that. It's pretty wild. My expectations were completely blown out of the water with this TV show. It's terrific. And the two coolest things about the TV show that Netflix has done for this, the main girl, Mildred Hubble, in the original, she was played by Fairuza Balk. In this one, she's played by Game of Thrones, the girl who runs Bear Island, like that totally badass little girl from Game of Thrones.
Lyanna Mormont?
Yeah, she's the lead. And then the headmistress bitch, like she's supposed to be kind of bitchy in this, she's Julia from Hellraiser. So I'm like, damn fine casting on the show, guys. I love it.
So it's a British show?
It's a British show. Yeah.
So wait, you're telling me that Fairuza Balk did The Worst Witch, The Craft, and then what was that post-craft ripoff witch movie that had a white cover on it. What was it called?
That was called Little Witches.
Little Witches. But, is that her? I don't think that's her.
She's not in Little Witches. And no. this
she's
is
not?
Like...
It's a picture that looks exactly yeah. like her.
Oh, they fooled
this
me.
This is back like Return to Oz. Like The Craft, you figure, was 96. So this yeah. is 86 when the original Worst Witch came out. So this is like Return to Oz for Ruzabak with like the big long braids on either side when she was still
cool
like a kind of creepy
that was
kid.
A great movie.
Return to Oz.
That's a really smart
it's
movie.
It's trippy and weird.
Yeah. It's weird, the Wheelers. But anyway, if you have kids, especially young females, check out The Worst Witch. It's worth it.
I've watched the Stranger Things season 2 trailer multiple times and
over it's
and
over. Gorgeous.
I haven't done it yet.
It trailer the second trailer for it
excellent.
Multiple times.
Also excellent.
I gotta say, great trailers. Stoked for both.
Yes,
like I can't like. I watched the Stranger Things trailer on my computer, and then I had it on Apple TV on my TV, and I just turned up the volume.
Yep.
Holy crap, it's a good trailer. It's very effective.
Elric, I would even say, I know this is...
You think I should do it?
Yeah,
I think
do it.
Stranger
do it,
Things,
okay. All right.
because
I'm
it is...
Excited
it is
anyway.
Already, it's 3 minutes long. It's already my favorite film of the year.
What?
It's really
I love
well
the trailer.
They
it's
used
such
Vincent Price's voiceover from the Thriller.
Oh, okay.
It's
yeah.
so
it's
good.
Great. And
it's
I don't think... Really yeah, you're not going to get that experience yeah. watching, I'm sure, season 2. But there are just so many elements that speak to me. It's like, okay, you like Stranger Things? Yes, I do. Do you like Halloween? Yes, I do. Do you like trick-or-treating? Yes, I do. Did you... create your own Ghostbusters costume
yep.
using
Tried.
Shoe boxes and duct tape and all sorts of other
and a
stuff.
Frisbee.
And
That's
a frisbee and a wiffle ball bat. Yes, I did. Did you play Dragon's Lair and spend a lot of money? Yes, I did. Were you scared of Thriller? Fuck yeah, I was. Yeah. Give it all to me now. Yeah. And I love that trailer. It, which was inspired, Stranger Things, guys.
Yeah.
Let's just not reverse that.
Yeah.
Same actor, too, right? Same
yeah.
boy.
Yeah, yeah, same yeah, actor. I'm seeing a lot of articles that are like, it looks so inspired by Stranger Things. It's like, no, reverse that.
It's because everyone that's writing it is 24.
So. the It trailer is really well done.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you hear Pennywise just say something once, and you're like, okay, that works. But
well, I like it. I was nervous that he was going to be creepy the whole time. Mm-hmm. And also the fact that they cast such a young actor as Pennywise. But the second I heard his voice, it's really unsettling because he does sound like a kid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't you want your balloon? You're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Okay. And also his eyes.
Chills. Yeah, the eyes.
Yeah, the eyes.
Like his eyes look like it, like they're almost like faulty contacts, but that they're not. Like it's really funny because they're actually playing on the eyes quite a bit. And he's got such intense stare. When they showed like the illustration of Pennywise in the old tome, whatever they're looking at, he's got the fucking eyes in there.
Yeah.
I was like, ah,
it's cool.
It's really well done.
It's gonna be cool.
Anyways, when this airs, it'll be old news. But
right,
I mean,
but
like,
still,
I'll probably have watched
we'll
it five more times.
It, yeah,
I'm still very watching excited.
It.
Very excited. I like event horror, you know. And this feels like it's gonna be 2 hours and like 5 minutes or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
Wow. Okay.
And then it's only if it does well will we get the adult sequel.
From my understanding, because
somebody told me a couple days ago that they filmed a bunch of extra stuff with the kids in order for directly for a sequel. Just
that makes sense.
Yeah, because they
won't be able to get them back.
Yeah. They will do flashbacks if they.
So it's additional footage. So
it's really
cool.
Smart.
It is smart, and I don't know
I
the way
so. I really
the way
hope
it's
does.
Tracking and the way people are excited about it. It seems huge. So I think it's going to be really great.
When is that? When is that? In October or
September 8th?
It is. Yeah, September 8th.
I got two more quick ones. BJ, did you have anything else you want to turn? Okay. So let me do these and then we will
take
it'll lead us into our and we'll take a break and
take
it'll lead
break.
Us into our topic. But first up is I don't know why I got in the mood to see this, but The Mighty Carpenter. I think we were just talking about John Carpenter stuff online and I went for Ghosts of Mars. From
I've been really itching to watch that.
I know,
3 months ago.
Well, here's the funny thing. So I threw it on because I'm like, you know what? I don't care. I got to give this another chance. I only saw it probably when it initially came out on video. And the thing is this, it's not bad. It's not great.
I said that last year when I watched it, and you guys about like pounded down on me.
I've never
poo-pooed you.
You did because it
did,
was about 4 months ago. I was like, it's not bad, guys.
Because I think I said I want to revisit and give it another chance.
Not
the
bad.
The thing that doesn't work about it, or the toughest, it's way too long. It's like an hour and 40 minutes, and you could easily. There's so much. There's just especially towards the third act where it's like just wall to wall action, but you're at a point where you're kind of unengaged. You're like, what the hell's going on here? But basically, it's the typical premise. They're on Mars and they're transferring a prisoner, and it just happens to be Ice Cube, who's like the biggest badass ever. It's actually very Riddick
Not the Riddick. What's the first Riddick movie? Pitch Black.
Pitch Black.
It's kind of like that, but then I guess
the world is run by a matriarchy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
yeah.
All the women in power, like it's like Pam Grier. Who are the main?
Pam Grier's in it.
Natasha Henstridge.
I remember
like
the main.
I thought the like the main government officials. I thought they were somebody too, but I could be blanking on it.
Yeah, and I didn't recognize anybody there. But yeah, Pam Grier is like the main officer. And then, you know, you look at everybody in the movie, and I think just in a small part, like Robert Carradine's one of the guys at the facility.
Yeah, everything about it should be awesome.
But you look at it, like everyone in the cast is notable. What's the girl's name from Faculty? Clea Duvall. She's in it. Just like everyone's recognizable, including Mr. Jason Statham, way before he was Jason Statham.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff that's cool in the movie, but it's definitely a pacing thing. I mean, yeah, it's kind of cool the fact that there's some sort of ghosts or something that they've unleashed that are taking over people's bodies, like almost like a virus. So it's kind of got that thing to it, but with ghosts. But
well, probably Planet of the Vampires is the same thing.
Yeah.
That's what Planet of the Vampires is.
Oh, that is the plot.
It's probably the exact same film.
The thing that doesn't work about it is just kind of the pacing, and it's a little bit too much. If it was a little bit more refined of a movie. Now, that said, the two things that stand out to me that I love – where because literally as soon as I'd watched it, I think it was Tony Giles was posting something about Statham, and you immediately posted, "We got a situation here, guys."
Which is a clip of
Jason Statham from it. And I watched that clip again right after seeing the movie. I was like, I do love that scene. That's right. It's when Jason Statham first finds like the leftover people with their heads all on stakes.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And he like starts to see the possessed people.
Yeah.
And he phones in, and it's not his finest hour.
But the funny thing is it's like a minute and a half long scene of all the possessed people wearing like leather. One woman's got like severed hands for like as a bra.
Yeah.
And then you got the wild main bad dude going rah 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 rah. That's like how they speak in Martian.
Yeah, very Marilyn Manson.
And after all of this, then Statham's like, we got a situation here.
It's great. I love about it. I was like, I kind of love that scene. And leading into that,
are you talking about the soundtrack?
I was going to say, yeah. The music to that scene is amazing. Yeah, and the soundtrack's amazing. And what's great is on the Blu-ray, it's only 6 minutes long, but there's a couple of featurettes and there's the music of Ghosts of Mars.
Yep.
And this was scored by Anthrax, the band Anthrax.
Wow.
And so the 6 minute featurette is John Carpenter in a studio with Anthrax and fucking Buckethead.
Yep.
Like all these, and he's just like headbanging. Like, like it. Keep going. Yeah. Do it.
He's doing it with him. Like, Bashar was part of that too.
Joe Bashar. Yeah. I mean, they're all. So it's worth it to watch 6 minutes of Carpenter and Anthrax and Buckethead and Bashar all in the studio recording this stuff. So not top tier Carpenter, but not nearly as bad as you remember. And there's some cool things in it.
And from memory, isn't it also a Rashomon remake? Because it's showing things from three distinct perspectives on remembering an event.
So I think it
says Kurosawa.
And it has a flashback within a flashback.
Oh. But no dog's flashback in this
No
one.
Dog no flashback.
Just has a flashback.
Check your expectations.
Yeah,
for me, it was always a pacing thing. It was more like it's kind of a boring movie. It has all the materials, all the makings of a really cool movie. But
yeah.
But it's also got the Western element.
Yeah, that's
there's
what.
There's that train, the big train chase sequence.
Is the closest besides,
And I always, it always felt like a Western to me because it's this outpost and, you know, it was pretty much if you subbed out Mars for like an old West mine, you're still getting that same thing with like the villagers attacking or whoever. So
that's
it does feel very much like a Western. But for me, it always felt more like an exploitation film just because it does have Pam Grier and the way that the lines are delivered. It does feel like
if it was lower budget. It would be cool. Yeah, you're probably right.
Like it takes itself seriously. Like it's a massive studio film with a huge budget. And then the actual script and like the hands on it doesn't take itself seriously.
It's funny that like because both Pam Grier and Jason Statham are trying really hard to sleep with Natasha Hendricks because Pam Grier is like the lesbian officer, and some of the stuff that Statham says is pretty inappropriate to Natasha. He's trying really hard,
but appropriate for today's episode.
Sure.
Would you call that exploitation Marsploitation?
Marsploitation.
Hey.
Well,
that was
this
terrible,
point,
Ryan.
I know,
terrible.
I know.
Probably not.
I got nothing on this. But Carpenter was involved in a Mars movie prior to this. It was like a role-playing game. Yeah. I forgot what it was called. Shit, they made a movie with it. Tom Jane starred in it. And it was filled
the Brian De Palma one?
No. It was filled with all these CGI effects, and I forgot what it was called. I'm pulling it up. Keep talking. It's coming. But this satisfied the Carpenter urge to do Mars.
And to do a Western. It's a big dream.
I think it's pretty common knowledge. There's a lot of studio interference, and that this movie was kind of the one that got him out of the game for a while because of how terrible a time he had putting it together.
Yeah. Mutant Chronicles.
Was Thomas Jane and Ron Perlman. I don't think it was set on Mars.
It's not. Never mind. Yeah. I'm going nowhere.
Forget it.
Ron Perlman's in it. Yeah, it's vastly different from this one.
Yeah, let's take a break. I do have one more movie, but it actually ties into our topic, and I want to launch our topic with this movie because of its relation to I Spit on Your Grave. So
let's do it.
This will take no time for you listeners. This episode's brought to you by Fright Rags.
Now
we have a pretty awesome discount code for you. If you go to FrightRags.com, Fright-Rags.com and type in the discount code Shockwaves0817. Again, that's Shockwaves0817.
0817.
Womp womp. This is what happens when I look at numbers. I hate math.
Shockwave 0817.
As in August 2017.
Yes. Then you'll get a sweet discount. But
even on the Hornhead socks, the Madball socks.
Even
that is specific.
On the Hornhead Madball socks.
Elric has been obsessing over.
Do they have Screaming Mimi? I always like that one. It was like the Screaming Baseball.
And they have an April Fool's Day shirt. I think that is so great.
That is pretty great.
Yeah. That is specific.
They go pretty.
And they used to have a Hello Mary Lou shirt.
They did, and they even have the phone number on the back. It's pretty popular, but it's in the graveyard. But I know they do re-release those every once in a while.
How does that work? Is that a voting thing?
Yeah, it's a voting.
Yeah. I think you go there.
That's pretty cool.
So once you watch the movie, start voting on it and bring it back.
They've got great new Ben Cooper stuff.
They have
lounge pants. Lounge pants, socks.
I dare them to make underwear. Give me some boxer shorts.
With pumpkins on it or something? What do you want?
The thing.
The thing.
Boxer
shorts. I think teeth boxer shorts.
Yeah.
Or you could just go to like any horror film in which someone's running around in their skivvies and just try to emulate those style. You know,
let's just take horror to another level. Line. Yeah.
This is going to be the most difficult segue ever, guys. I can't go from panties to what we're talking about comfortably. I don't feel good about this.
All right. Well, hold on. So yeah, no, the Fright Rags, they always deliver great stuff. Top artists, it's usually original artwork from them.
Yep.
Right now they're about to do an Evil Dead 2 release to celebrate the 30th anniversary. That's on August 23rd. Evil Dead 2 is one of my favorite movies of all time. So you know they're going to do something cool for that. And it's the highest quality printed on super soft ring spun cotton shirts.
So again, that discount code is Shockwave0817.
Yes. And that's good until September 30th. Mm-hmm. So for the next 2 months, you could use that code and get a discount. Pretty good.
Okay. Pretty
good. All right. So how do we segue? Well, I saw a film that will lead us into our discussion. Again, as we mentioned at the top of the show, BJ had a blog when she first started writing called Day of the Woman, inspired by I Spit on Your Grave. And you didn't write. How did that start, actually? I don't even know. Like, was that the kind of thing you wrote about at first? Was things like I Spit on Your Grave? Or was that just a cool name for a horror blog?
A little bit of both. I started the blog because I was going stir crazy in my college dorm room and needed to do something with my time. But the thing that I wanted to focus on the most was kind of the unconventional feminist point of view of films. I feel that there's like a very big divide between either it's a very much a you're either with us or you're against us mentality when it comes to feminist film criticism. And I fall somewhere in the middle because I like to examine both sides. And I felt Day of the Woman was or I Spit in Your Grave was kind of the perfect example of that because people are so divided. There's really nobody who falls in the middle on that film. And that's kind of where the name came from. And that was my main focus. And then people, obviously they knew I was a female, but then when they realized that I was at the time 18, then I became like this niche, like, holy crap, like this very, very, very young, born in 1990 person is talking about films from the 70s. This is kind of unheard of. And it's kind of spiraled all from there.
Wow.
Well, the thing that I've said this off record, and I've said it probably in previous episodes, but rape revenge horror is probably my least favorite subgenre. I kind of lump it in with torture porn, which is a terrible name for it, but anything that falls in that realm is just really difficult.
Well, you and I are cut from the same cloth when it comes to horror movies. You know, you and I kind of favor horror comedies more than most things in terms of subgenres. So anything that makes me feel slightly unpleasant, you know, I'm just kind of like, okay, fine, I'm going to confront that. I'll take it. You know, I'll watch anything. Mm. Honestly, I'll watch anything. But it's not like something I'll go, well, I'm just going to pop in. I spit on your grave this afternoon and just kind of kick back and eat some popcorn.
It's not like a Friday night movie.
No.
But the contradiction to that is I will watch Last House on the Left.
Really?
See, yeah, and that's also my least favorite Wes Craven movie because of how
there's some sort of weird thing like that just keeps pulling me in to reassess it more than anything else when it comes to the subgenre. There's something gritty about it. There's something really raw. And it's probably about the first time I saw it was like in high school.
And some are like a little more overtly political. And the person making it is clearly trying to say something, whether it comes across clear. And a lot of them are completely exploitation or to sexualize the act. And unfortunately, people can't. For one, I don't think it's meant to be a genre. I don't think it's meant to be a subgenre, the rape revenge. I think we as fans and critics
it's a narrative
have
more than anything.
Yeah, it's definitely the three-act structure. And actually, Wikipedia even defined it when I was like Googling rape revenge films today. Like Wikipedia even said, a rape revenge film, act one, the character is raped or gang raped and left for dead. Act two, she survives and rehabilitates. Act three, revenge or kills the rapist. And so it's definitely like a path, very much like, you know, an epic or any other type of formula. It just has gotten lumped into this grouping.
Yeah. And there's some other mainstream examples that weren't in the exploitation that, and that was man on man, like Deliverance was a major one. And that was like a mainstream in everyone's home watching the storyline. And, you know, that when you think about it, would have made a lot of people uncomfortable too, just because it is a man raping another man, you know, especially the, you know, and then having a super masculine character like Burt Reynolds enter the narrative, it's not as challenging, I don't think, because it's so easy to see what it is. You know what kind of movie that is. When you watch these movies, the line between eroticizing the act or politicizing it, it's almost hard to tell.
Yeah.
Virgin Spring, easy to tell. You know what, it had a very clear, it doesn't feel like they're just exploiting something, but then Last House muddles it. And the only thing that would tip you that it is politicized is probably Wes Craven, just knowing something about the guy.
Same with The Hills Have Eyes, where it feels so tacked into Hills Have Eyes that a lot of times you can't tell what it is. But like Hills Have Eyes is one that I always return to. Like I enjoy watching that film, even though that I know that the scene's coming and I know it's going to be unpleasant. But I still don't mind watching that film. But
are you talking about the original?
The original.
The movie I wanted to mention before, Scream Factory just put this out and I'd never even heard of it. And it's from 1980 and it's called Demented.
Oh God. I got 20 minutes in. It's one of the movies I've turned off in a long time.
Wow.
And not just because it was so gross, just I hated it. I was like, this is terrible.
All right. Well, I made it through the whole thing. No, and I was so surprised by this movie because the rape of the main girl happens in the first minute. Yep. It's like the movie opens and she's attacked by a group of men in like a horse, horse stall or whatever. And so you're kind of like, whoa, they're not even going to waste any time. They're getting right to that aspect of it. And then what happens after that is that she, you know, obviously she goes to like a mental hospital or whatever. And they make it clear that all the guys were caught, etc. Her husband brings her home, but she's kind of damaged. And at the same time, her husband, because of this, is kind of like cheating on her. So he's like off having an affair with another woman. And then there's not really – I don't want to say there's no rhyme or reason because I guess there sort of is. I just don't understand. I just think they're terrible kids. But I guess there's like a group of boys in town that decide, let's put on a bunch of masks and just like, you know, when she's home alone, like mess with her or whatever. So they do. And then she just goes completely nuts and starts – because she can't tell if they're real or not.
Right.
You know, she's obviously had this like traumatic experience.
Like repulsion.
Yeah, yeah. So she just starts like hacking away at these kids in masks. It's kind of over the top and crazy. But what struck me about it was
This is 1980, and what was I Spit on Your Grave, 1978 or so? Mm-hmm. So this is like directly right after that.
And maybe it was filmed right then. It could have been right on the path of it.
So my question is, do we consider I Spit on Your Grave the first of this type of film, or is it just the first to exploit it? Or because when I think of rape revenge movies that are being exploitive, I think that they're trying to rip off I Spit on Your Grave. Mm. I don't think they're going back to Virgin Spring or Last House.
Last House is just remaking.
I was going to say, let's pose that to our guest. I mean, BJ, what do you think?
I mean, I don't think that I Spit on Your Grave is kind of what started it, but it's definitely the one that, because the rape is so long and it's so notorious, that has then become the standard that people are trying to emulate, because you really can't get worse than that. Yeah. So that is what they're trying to rip off. Very similar to how, you know, you would say that like Friday 13th didn't invent the slasher, but it kind of perfected it, which saying something perfected a rape revenge is awful, but it's kind of what happened. And it gained so much notoriety, both from, you know, audiences and critics, that's kind of like the granddaddy of all of them.
Yeah. I guess the quintessential of that type of film.
And the revenge scenes are also equally crazy.
Yeah. And it also, it really kind of fine-tuned it, because we did have rape revenge before this. I mean, Shakespeare has one. Titus Andronicus boils down to a rape revenge film, where in the final act, if I remember correctly, there's actually three spirits. They're portrayed as like the fate, but they are the spirits of murder, rape, and revenge. And so Titus Andronicus did it. Virgin Spring obviously did it. It's been around for a while, but I think that Day of the Woman kind of cut out all of the other plot elements, whereas before that was kind of a driving force of the movie. It literally is the movie now. Like, there was nothing else there. It boiled it down.
What's before I Spit on Your Grave that you would consider that to fall into this?
To rape revenge? I would say, Last House on the Left. I would definitely say
Thriller.
A Cruel Picture.
Yeah.
That's super exploitive. That's purposely like an exploitation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Almost born.
Ilsa, when was that? Thriller, A Cruel Picture?
It might have been like 76 or something.
I think 73.
A lot of the Nazi exploitations also used rape revenge as one of the plot points. And so that would have come in before this. It wasn't obviously the primary plot point, but that was definitely included in a lot of them. Like even Ilsa, it definitely plays into it.
What was your experience watching that film the first time? Was it an emotional experience, or was it a critical, because obviously if you're going to use that particular film as your title for your blog, it has some significance.
So this is where it gets kind of heavy, but it doesn't have to be. And that's why I talk about it, because a lot of people can't. And I think that if you can talk about it, if you're not that traumatized, you should. But when I was 15, I was brutally assaulted by an ex-boyfriend and some of his friends to an alarming degree. And I went through a lot of therapy and nothing seemed to really snap me out of it. I was kind of on this spiraling path of destruction. And I went to the video store and I saw Ms. 45 was actually my first one. Mm. And I went home and I watched it and I wasn't sure how to feel about it. So I went back to the video store, I went to return it. And the guy behind the counter was like, "Oh, if you watch that, you should watch this." And he took me home with I Spit on Your Grave. And I think it was the lack of score, the lack of pulling the camera away. Like, you don't get to look at the birds or look at, you know, the woods. Like, you have to look at everything. Right. And not only that, but then you also have to watch her walk home. And it's all of the aftermath of it all really, really resonated with me. And I saw for the first time, I mean, this happened in the early 2000s. So Law and Order SVU was a huge thing for me. So my only exposure at that point to any sort of portrayal of assault survivors was SVU, where everybody is this has ended their life. Now they're all depressed and everyone's on drugs. And this was the first time that I ever saw a rape survivor be fuck this. I'm not going to let this ruin my life. It's a thing that happened. I feel angry about it. I'm going to do something with that anger, but it's not going to define me forever. And that was the light bulb. And I was not only did this really help me get through what I was going through, but that was the light bulb that made me realize that I'm fascinated by film theory and how films affect people in their real lives or psychologically. Mm. I probably watched the movie 6 times in a weekend. I just had to keep watching it and picking apart every single piece of it. So that was my main exposure to it. And then I was alarmed at how little research or like academia has really been done about the topic. Like Carol J. Clover has done some stuff, but she's done everything. But mostly it's people that are like, these are trash. This movie's awful. Like, mm-hmm. don't watch this. Don't do this. And I was like, no, like there's a lot of good that comes out of these films that we don't talk about.
Why do you think that that's the initial reaction?
I think the initial reaction is because the difference between like an exploitation film, like, you know, Faster, Pussycat, Kill, Kill is there's nothing fun about rape revenge because it's not something that's over the top. Like, it's something that's real. Like, I've heard people make the argument that like Ms. 45 is unbelievable. Like, nobody gets raped by two people in one night.
Wasn't that just a news report?
Yeah. It just happened last week. Yeah. Like, yeah. A girl came out of the woods, got to the side of the road and said, please help me. I've been raped. And the guy was like, sure, I'll help you. Got her in the car. And then he raped her. Oh. It's like, awful. This awful. Is real life.
Yeah.
And that's why I think.
It was in the UK last year.
Yeah. I think that's why people are so quick to say, well, these movies are, you know, exploitive or they're garbage because statistically, like, you probably know somebody who has been assaulted. And that is such an uncomfortable truth that people don't want to deal with. Like, one of the comparisons I always say is that, like, I can sit at a dinner table of people and say, hey, I'm a cancer survivor. And everyone's like, oh, you're so brave. Mm. And then I'll say, hey, I'm also a sexual assault survivor. And they're like, I don't want to talk about that. That's really mm-hmm. uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And that's where that line is. So I think it's people's initial reaction of, like, that upsets me. I don't want to deal with it. Mm-hmm. That they have completely turned off analyzing or looking into some films that have a lot of merit and are trying to say something very important.
I also think that there's a misconception in academia that these things are put on screen to be fetishizing of it.
Correct.
And that is not the case for a lot of filmmakers.
Absolutely.
I definitely think that there are certain films that do fetishize rape, but the majority of the ones that you see, especially in the horror genre, are not intending to do so. But I think that a lot of people, especially in the academia world, kind of back away slowly from it because they don't want to be confusing or, you know, in any way thinking that these may be fetishizing it.
Right. And I think that people draw this incorrect correlation that invoking bad feelings or bad emotions make something a bad movie. Mm. And that's not true at all. And at the same time, like, showing an accurate portrayal of something terrible is not glorifying it. It's showing an accurate portrayal. The same way, like, by that argument, you could say that, like, childbirthing videos are exploitation because, like, that's gross. I don't want to see that. But it's like, no, that's what really happens. And in a lot of these rape revenge films, yes, some of them are purely trying to, like, profit off of rape culture, which is super gross. But there are films where they're trying to give you an accurate portrayal. And yeah, it's uncomfortable. You're going to feel gross. If you don't feel gross, there's something wrong with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it's a cash grab, if it's like, oh, that movie I Spit in Your Grave did well, let's make our own one.
That's exploitation.
Yeah. That's Mirzachi's story, and you maybe share a little bit. It's kind of amazing. I only heard it recently, you know, why he made that movie.
Yeah, he found a girl who was kind of stumbling out of the woods and said, I've been attacked. I need help. And he was so upset that, you know, this is a problem and was happening. And this is right at the peak of kind of second wave feminism, which focused very heavily on like women's sexuality and especially with rape culture and identifying that like this is a bigger problem than we think it is. So he wanted to do something about it. And I think that's why I respect that movie so much is because you know that it's coming from a place of like, I'm trying to use art as therapy. I'm trying to send a message. I'm trying to say something. And this is the only way I can get people to listen. And to some extent, like, he made one of the most talked about movies in history. Mm-hmm. So he did his job.
And I think most people, like, I remember growing up, people who don't know that story just think he's a total scumbag. I've heard so many people go, oh, that guy is such an exploitative scumbag. And then you hear that and go, wow, so this the impetus of where a story comes from versus how it's perceived are totally different. I wanted to ask you about the catharsis of, because to me, cinema in general is ultimately about catharsis. Any story is about giving you something, a situation, and you get to the end, you feel something, you're a little bit of relief. These films are basically the structure, like what Becca was just saying. The structure is this event, which would also say, hopefully, it's going to provide some catharsis. And I don't mean like personal necessarily. Mm-hmm. Like to you, obviously, that film, that's a different scenario. But like when you watch that film, do you think it offers a viewer real catharsis? Or is it then, is the exploitation perhaps actually the killings that she's doing? Is that the exploitive part? I don't know.
I think that is where the exploitation lives in kind of the manipulation that she has in these killings more than the actual like rape scene, because that to me, like that's like watching a medically accurate like
depiction.
Yeah. Like that's real. Okay. It's everything after that, that I think is where it kind of falls into the world of exploitation. But at the same time, I think it's a really nice, I don't want to say nice, that's gross. but her kind of like her killing spree is like, that is a sense of release that like so many people don't get, is that like, what do I do with all these negative emotions? And obviously that's not to say this movie is encouraging like vigilante justice or people to like go out and kill other people for committing these crimes. But that idea of being able to express that is so cathartic. And I think a lot of people, you have to know who you are as a person before you walk into it. Obviously, you could make the argument with like that movie To the Bone that's on Netflix, which is about like anorexia people, like, oh, it's triggering. If you yourself know that you are triggered by looking at thin women that may make you relapse, don't watch it.
Yeah.
If you're a assault survivor and you can't watch Game of Thrones, don't watch I Spit in Your Grave. If you think you can handle this, watch it. It may bring you some release, but it is important that the viewer knows their own limitations, because it's not for everybody. And to kind of wave it with this blanket flag of like, it's trash and it's bad for everybody, like that is a bigger problem. That's where you get into weird censorship issues.
Right, where you can't even the first time when, just thinking about the first time I noticed the difference between one that I felt like gets maybe a bad rap for being misogynist, because that's a tough, it's such an easy label to throw on and act that, because what if it's about that thing? It's easy to say, well, that's misogynist. And you're like, but it's about misogyny. Isn't misogyny hiding the fact that you're a misogynist?
Not exactly.
But the one I really noticed, and I'd be curious to know your feelings on this, when I first saw the first Death Wish, that act to me, which everyone just always goes, oh, it's misogynist, I'm like, it's so ugly and repulsive. As a man, if I think people should be forced to watch that in Irreversible, young, like 18-year-old boys should be forced to watch Irreversible, because I guarantee you, you're not going to, how could somebody have those thoughts or feelings if they were faced with that? But then when I saw Death Wish 2, that scene, it felt like pure exploitation, made me feel so uncomfortable, and that I could tell somebody was doing it for money. Like the scenes of the rape and that are so different than how I felt in the first one, which is just scared for the woman. And this one, I'm like, oh my God, you're trying to titillate with a rape scene, which is disturbing.
No, I agree with you completely.
It's so weird, isn't it?
Yeah, that is the sharpest difference, I think, is how it's shot, how it's presented. Is the camera unyielding? Like in Irreversible, I don't think the camera moves. Like literally, I think it's the same shot.
Right.
I think it's the same shot the whole time. And that's how it feels during Day of the Woman or I Spit on Your Grave. Like and Death Wish, actually, it feels unyielding. By part two, it does feel completely different. So a lot of it is in the style of how you're filming it.
Well, also you're using the crux of you're making, and there's a lot in Death Wish 2 I really like after that. But when I think, because it's a fun film, but you think about it and you're like, did you need another rape to make a sequel to a movie about a vigilante? You know what I mean?
Right.
That's where the exploitation comes in. Well, it worked in the first movie.
Yes.
Let's replicate. Yeah. And that's where it feels wrong. That's where I'm like, no.
I agree completely. I mean, I have very, very, very strong feelings about the reboot and sequels of the I Spit on Your Grave franchise.
Right.
Because to me, that looks like we are purely trying to profit off of an existing name and profit off of rape culture. And that's so gross to me.
Yeah.
And seeing kind of how extreme those kills are, they found the line and then like did a flying leap over
it. What they did is they took a take of torture porn, more or less, and they were like, okay, how do we get to these moments of murder and mayhem? And it's like, oh, we need to use the old rape crutch again. You know, it's like, Jesus Christ.
And that's where we saw, and to be honest, I find the rape films that came out directly after the torture porn craze to be far more exploitive than the ones that came out in the 70s. Because the ones that came out in the 70s, it feels, I don't want to say more organic, but it does. It feels like it's the point of the movie. Is to look at how horrible this is and look at it as an atrocity.
Well,
and it's the focal
more,
point.
Yeah, and there's probably just more thought.
Yeah, and then by the time that we have that post kind of post-hostile torture porn craze that comes out, it's like, oh, we're torturing teens. We should throw a rape in for good measure. And you see it come up in so many movies. And even when I was looking over the list today, it was literally like the majority of these movies were either from the 70s and they were ones that I've seen, or there was a glut of them in the mid to late 2000s where I was like, I don't even recall half these films, but they're listed as rape revenge films because there's a rape in them.
Yeah. Are there any by, and I mean, there must be some, but any well-known, because I can't think of any directed by woman.
The Ladies Club.
MFA. Did you see MFA yet?
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that.
I talked about it a couple episodes back. Art student gets raped because she was invited over to a party by someone in her classroom that she really had eyes for. And then during the party, he took her upstairs and assaulted her. And then what had happened is she has the moment of confrontation. And during that conflict, she accidentally pushes him over a balcony and kills him. And through that, she starts to get a bloodlust and it starts to reinvigorate her art. A little conflicted about it, but I felt like the filmmaker had good intentions and she, you know, demonstrated a directing style that
MFA.
It just played at Fantasia.
A thinly veiled one, which probably no one will be thinking is this, but the reason why I like this movie is because there is Deborah Brockmay. When she made Slumber Party Massacre 2, it's so absurd. But when you really look at it, the guy's wielding this giant drill bit moving phallus. Mm-hmm. And there is all this talk of rape and assault at the start, but done in this very, you know, under the radar. So when I think about it, it's like, oh, maybe that's just a totally different approach to a topic done through, you know, a more zany way. It might not be a straight rape revenge film, but it kind of... I don't know. For me, that's a more interesting way to see a different approach
like
versus
a threat.
I don't know.
Demonstrated
and that
way.
You know, just yeah.
Though I can't recall. I mean, this movie, most of her work is so nuts to begin with. But I feel like Catherine Brûlé. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
I'm sure she has to, like
Fat Girl has rape. Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's
it ends with a major sequence.
Oh yeah, it
sequence,
does. Yeah.
Very political and in your face.
And that one is one that like I walk away from, and there's nothing. There's just like horrified and just disgust for the whole ordeal.
And I think something else that's always fascinated me is how closely related rape revenge films are with body horror, but you never think about it that way. Mm. When you're using a rape revenge, it's people. But when you have body horror, like you look at something like The Fly, and it very much is like rape culture-y of like, did Dr. Brendel deserve this? He should have looked at his machine and he didn't. And now he's infested by something without his consent and he has to deal with it. And that happens with a lot of body horror films, or, you know, you can even look at, like, I am one of the weirdos that defends, like, the tree rape scene in Evil Dead, and, like, people are like, that's exploitive, and it's gross, and this, that, and the other, but you have to think, like, that is kind of, like, the ultimate violation, if that's what, you know, deadites are going to be doing, is ultimately violating people, like, yeah, that's a thing that's going to happen. But body horror allows people to deal with kind of these topics of rape culture and like things entering you without your consent and like taking over your body and ruining your whole life. But it's done in such an over the top manner that you're able to distance yourself from it. Rape revenge doesn't allow you that distance. It's in your face. Like, no, this, you're dealing with this now. And I think that that's always fascinating is people who love body horror, but like hate rape revenge. I'm like, they're telling the same story. It's the exact same story that you're just changing the face of the person that's doing the crime.
I think that there are some good ones, at least a few that do kind of cross over, like Teeth, I mentioned before.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely is a rape revenge film, but also body horror. I would even put Dead Girl into that to an extent.
I would
Dead
do Girls. That too. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
And you know, which isn't a rape revenge and yet has all the hallmarks of the revenge part is and it's almost is rabid. Mm-hmm. And so, and that's a direct connector of your body horror idea.
Even Shivers too. Uh-huh.
And even thinking about The Fly, because the thing about not just rape, but it's also the control of women's bodies. And so the idea of like, oh, you must get an abortion or you're not going to get an abortion of that, The Fly child and stuff like that, wanting to control and dominate somebody else's body in either way, whether it's political. So I feel like Cronenberg, you're probably hitting on something for sure there about that aspect to his early work.
And I think too, like a lot of people complain about rape revenge films that have, you know, Last House on the Left is the one because it has the blowjob. And then I Spit in Your Grave has the seduction and castration. And everyone's like, why would that would never happen. But it's been like scientifically psychologically proven that a lot of people who have been sexually assaulted get like super into BDSM or like very rough, like sexual things, or they become overtly sexual. And it's a way to like take that power back that they have felt has been taken from them. So a lot of people see those scenes and they're like, that's gross. That's not a thing that would happen. It's like, oh no, that's absolutely how people would deal with it. It's, you know, if men are going to use this like sexuality as a weapon and exert power over women, like then why is it so hard to believe that the inverse could have this like the same effect and women are going to do the same thing?
Did you see A Big Little Lies? I actually just finished it last night. It's a dynamite show. Like it's seven parts with Nicole Kidman, Reese Witherspoon, but it's a direct relationship of what you're talking about between the guy who's the sexy guy from True Blood, the blonde guy, Skarsgård, is having an abusive relationship with his wife, Nicole Kidman. And it's like brutal. He beats her and then they have this crazy hot sex each time and until she realizes it's not really what they're having. Mm-hmm. And it's quite scary. Like that storyline's like quite disturbing to watch it unfold. And you really feel for that character. You know, it's funny how these things that if you hide them, I feel like they're more dangerous somehow.
Absolutely.
And yet it's not an enjoyable job. We're not meant to enjoy it. So it's got a weird place. Like why, I mean, to make one now, I'd be curious, like, what the motivation, what a new rape revenge. Can, I mean, if MFA is probably the most recent, right?
Well, there was also Verhoeven's movie. Did you see
I did see that. But that's, like, how recent is that?
That was last year.
It was last year? Yeah. Okay.
Because the mix of that was... there was a twist on it. I haven't seen it myself.
It's a hard one to talk about without giving too much away. It was actually my favorite movie of that year because it was so surprising. And I couldn't believe the way I was feeling. I was watching this thing because it opens. The opening second, she's in the midst of basically the savage attack. But the way she reacts to it is so unusual and surprising. You start to go, oh, yeah, you're right. You wouldn't – there isn't just one way to react to this.
And that's what it is, like I think – rape revenge films offer an alternative to what we've all kind of collectively decided is how victims are supposed to respond to these things. I think today is actually a really good time for this sort of thing because given the political climate, we're taking steps backwards and people aren't taking things as seriously. I mean, you get the whole like Brock Turner nonsense where he's raping somebody outside of a garbage can and gets nothing because it's going to ruin his swimming career. And it's like, what bizarre world did we just fall into?
And the saddest part of that story, if for those who didn't know, is he was only stopped by foreign exchange students, not Americans, who apparently some passed.
Yeah.
Freaking foreigners on their bike going, oh, we better, you know, it's like disgusting. You know?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And I think that there's definitely a message that needs to be brought back because it seems that the only time people listen is when you're being screamed at, and what better way to do that with film than to like put it in front of your face. And I think that we are having a much more politically aware society. So I think that people are going to hopefully take those precautions, but then at the same time, like you're going to get trash people. Like there's some like super shoestring budget filmmaker that made a movie that was called like Bill Huxtable Serial Rapist, and it was supposed to like be an exploitation film about Bill Cosby, and I was like, this is a trash mess. Why are you doing this? But I would be interested to see, you know, something kind of in the vein of like how Raw dealt with cannibalism, like something like that dealing with rape revenge, I think would be fascinating.
There's, I know from talking with other filmmakers, there's like this thing that you try to resist where like you're trying to find a way to kind of push your female characters. But the two things that I would never want to put in unless I had a really good means around it or a means to the end are a rape and then also a miscarriage. Because those are kind of like, and I've even heard other people in Hollywood say this, like, oh, you need a roughed up female character. Did she have a rape or a miscarriage? Like, those are the only two things that can really affect females in that way. So I know from talking with other female filmmakers that that's like a, you know, you don't want to do that just because it seems like what they expect.
Yeah, it seems like they want to reduce female characters to the control of their sexuality and, you know, whether or not they can or cannot have children because there's still this mentality that like you're not a true female or like a full woman unless you've had children. So to take a child away, if like that's the ultimate thing, and it's like I can't have kids, like that doesn't affect me. But that's like a very common thing is that the only way to show like a distressed woman is to fuck with kids or rape her. And
How did you feel about I just read a big one that just popped in my head that's super fairly recent and friends of pretty much everyone on the show, I think, is the Shoshka Twins, American Mary. And that was one that, like, there's a lot I liked about the movie, but when it took that turn, that definitely did make me feel, like, ooh, uncomfortable and gloomy, and it was almost too much for me. But I think it probably was integral to that story. How did you feel about that portrayal?
The portrayal of it didn't really bother me. I did think I liked kind of the message because they're dealing with like people that are working in like the strip club and like the sex work industry. And a lot of people then make the assumption that like, well, if you do that, then you're asking for it. And I thought that was a take that I hadn't really seen. I'm not a huge fan of the film as a whole, but that has nothing to do with that particular turn. I don't think that it's a like a bad portrayal. I don't think that it's exploitive. But the movie itself didn't really do much for me, so it's hard for me to be like, yeah.
Taking the scholarly approach in terms of listeners who are who might not have ever seen anything, obviously beyond I Spit on Your Grave, what else would you tell them to kind of dig into?
So Miss 45 is a big one. Mm-hmm. But that similar to like Thriller, A Cruel Picture, like there's a lot of mute rape revenge movies, just like women who can't talk and just raping them. That's like a weird thing.
Savage Streets, that one character. I mean, I love Savage Streets, but the one character is just, it's brutal.
Right,
Virgin Spring, which we talked about.
There's a Japanese one that I've recommended on the show a couple of times before called Freeze Me. That I'm always a little more fascinated by. It does, and again, like the Japanese rape films are a whole different bag. Like
they
I don't even
know. They have a lot of sexual issues going on over there.
Yeah, it's much more kind of a fetishization with it in certain films. But with Freeze Me, there was something about that that I found really compelling that I'm still fascinated by. I don't know what to make of it. It's one of these where I'm kind of on the fence. I don't know if I like this film or if I'm repulsed by it, but there's something about the message that I find really compelling. So I recommend, you know, at least giving it a second look.
I actually prefer the Last House on the Left remake's portrayal of assault. The original one does feel super, super gritty, but like my problem with that is I kind of go with the Carol Clover approach that like if somebody else is doing the revenge for you, then it's not like it. That's where it definitely falls. Like rape revenge is a narrative and not a subgenre because someone else is doing it for them. Same thing with I think it's 7 Days where it's I think it's a French movie where the dad finds his like young child rapist and then just tortures him for 2 hours. For 7 days.
7 days.
I never saw, and it's weird that I didn't see it because I actually think Irreversible is a really important movie and it really did a lot for me. But then I never saw Baz et Moi, which is literally Rape Me, is actual English. Did you see that one? Because that's meant to be empowering. But
yeah,
I
have seen it. It wants to be empowering.
I was not empowered by it.
No.
It to me felt far more like shock. Yeah. Like much more like shocksploitation where it's like, oh my God, I can't believe everything that we put on screen. Like,
and
it
they
just
adult
feels
industry
like,
actors, right?
Yeah.
As part of the appeal to
yeah,
make it.
Yeah, that's why people wanted to
sexual.
Watch it. Because the other thing too, especially with this genre or narrative, whatever you want to call it, is you have to take into account country of origin because we live in such a puritanical country where like, you can't even have sex ed in schools that people throw in a tantrum. So it's when you get into like Japanese or French or, you know, European, especially where they're a lot more open about sexuality. The portrayal is going to be wildly different because their idea of extreme is totally different than ours.
And their approach is really different. Cause I know there's a film that Elric and I have both kind of showed appreciation for called Go Go Second Time Virgin. I can't even remember the name of the filmmaker, Watsumatsu. It was this Japanese filmmaker who pretty much spent his entire life studying Godard and decided he was going to make a rape revenge film, but make it like Godard. But it's still made with this Japanese mentality. So it's got these strangely comedic scenes, beautifully shot. It is like the most beautifully shot. He ended up making another one. I can't remember. Ecstasy of the Angels.
There was
the second one that he did as
they
well.
They can make you feel like shit, but they could still narratively or cinematically engage you. And that's, I guess, where that's part of the friction comes from inside you. Like, I can only speak from a male's perspective watching it, but like there is a conflict to some of that work. Not all of it, but when it's titillating, that's something you can't really pin down. Because, I mean, and this is probably being a little too honest, but I'm not kidding. When I saw Evil Dead as a kid, I mean, that was kind of, I didn't realize that was like rape when I'm watching
it. I think I was like 10
and there was something kind of titillating about that. Yeah. And then I grow up and go, oh, fuck, that makes me feel really weird
right.
and bad about that feeling because you can't control your sexuality, how you react to stimulus.
Exactly.
You can control yourself from not raping. you know?
And
that's the difference.
Yeah, and that's what's super important is that a lot of times people say like, oh, well, these movies are titillating. They're doing this. And it's like, well, if they're intentionally trying to titillate you, I get it.
Yeah.
If they're not trying to, and that's the response you're having, like that's something that you as a person need
to
assess.
Yeah,
that's not the film's fault. I mean, there are plenty of things like I mentioned Game of Thrones earlier, and like there are characters on that that are repulsive, awful people that I'm like, still would. And that is a reflection of me, not a reflection of the show. And the same goes with, you know, I think that's kind of like our most like modern portrayal, because like while Game of Thrones is supposed to be written in like an older age, it's got a mentality of a more awoke, like a woke mentality. Yeah. So their approach is thinking with today's audiences in mind, and people still are like, no, you can't do this. You can't do this. It's bad. And it's like, if you are responding to this by thinking like, oh, they're glorifying it, then you need to understand what the difference between exposure and glorification is.
Mm-hmm. And every rape in that show is about power. Every single one.
Because,
is a direct
because
power
ultimately
point.
That is what it is. Exactly. Like rape has nothing to do with sexuality. It has everything to do with power.
Mm-hmm. And they do that really well, and they do it really honestly. And that's what's so disturbing about it. And that's why it kind of works in that show.
Yep. And that's why people get so upset, because there's no fun in this form of exploitation, because it is real. And then that also makes people want to step aside from seeing it as like a horror film, because it's not a monster. It's not a slasher. It's real. And it's not just like a real boogeyman, but it's a real boogeyman that for whatever reason we cannot beat. And that is the scariest part of all of it.
And no one's made a film where that's fully come true, like where the raped character comes back literally as a monster. I mean, I know Repulsion kind of has that, and so does Rabbit a bit, even though they're not quite that. But I'm just imagining someone taking that fantastic approach of going all out, and it becomes actually the monstrous, you know. But I can't think of
one. Yeah, I feel like that's been done, but I can't think of one.
It really might have, but.
Yeah. It's not raising any.
Yeah.
Liquid Sky does that to a degree. Not that I would call that the world's greatest rape revenge film. It's fascinating. And it's another one I'm on the fence of, where I don't know what to make of it, where it's a girl who aliens have kind of attacked her, and every single person who has an orgasm within her presence dies. And so she gets raped a couple of times, and her attackers immediately die. And it's kind of like looking at this, but it's all set in this New York art world. And so she ends up becoming kind of the unwilling monster, where she's killing all of these people, but they're all rapists. And so it's a bizarre film to begin with. The filmmaking is completely whack. It's really trippy and psychedelic, but it does have that interesting angle where she unwillingly becomes the monster and also the victim simultaneously.
I think the closest, and this is a stretch, but I'm not the first one to have the take. A lot of people agree with it, that Maleficent is a rape revenge story.
I read that today. Absolutely. It totally is.
Absolutely. It's not, you know, rape in the sense of like penetration, but you know, the removal of the wings, and then she becomes like this uncontrollable, like demon, monster, witch, whatever you want to call her. That's definitely a rape revenge film.
Absolutely.
Like that's a rape revenge film Disney for kids.
Did Disney ever take it, or any of the creators ever take a stance on that? Because I saw it, but I never followed any of the press afterwards.
Yeah, I don't think anyone ever. I think they just wanted it to go away.
Yeah, because there was a really.
I mean, it was so blatant. Oh,
there was a. I remember right after Disney came out, it was maybe a week later, there was a really good Huffington Post article that somebody sent me that was literally called, "We Need to Talk About the Rape Scene in Maleficent."
Yeah.
And it was a great article that went through how it was a rape scene, how the whole movie functioned as a rape revenge, and how she was ultimately a rape victim. Mm-hmm. And it was a great article. But yeah, I don't know if Disney ever said. I think they buried it.
And
yet, like, they smuggled it in, and the creators definitely smuggled it in there.
Well, like one of the most popular teen shows this year was the entire show is a structure is a rape revenge show, which is the 13 Reasons are literally revenge is this very concocted plan, but it's totally rape revenge.
We did a back-to-back pieces. Meredith Borders wrote for Birth, Movies, Death about why she hated it, and then I wrote about why I liked it, and it was for that exact reason.
That's awesome that you guys did that.
And it was, they cross-posted it for like Forever Young Adult as well, which is like very much geared towards that audience. And it's been really interesting. Like, everybody has been hating on it, and they're like, oh, this is, you know, it's triggering, it's this, it's that, and the other. And I'm like, something being triggering for some people does not devalue its merit. Mm-hmm. And that's something that people have to shake off. Mm-hmm. Like, you look at like even something like old like blaxploitation films, like Rudy Ray Moore films, and people are like, these are blatantly racist. Like, is it, or is it empowering and it makes you uncomfortable because you're not in on it?
See, according to Rudy Ray Moore, they were never in any way, they weren't making like racist films. They were just making films.
Exactly. Yeah. And like that's kind of similar with the people who aren't trying, because if they're not trying to profit off of like the rape revenge thing, like you look at Amir Zarchi, like he's not trying to make like this rape revenge thing. He's making
a franchise. He wasn't making sequels.
That no, other he was people making, did. Yeah. He was, this was his response to real life.
Right.
And people just need to shake that shit off and realize that it's not one linear vision. Like, there's a lot of different interpretations to the content.
Now, in the same regard as Maleficent, I've always viewed The Crow as a rape revenge film.
I agree completely.
Straight up. And even though that she's not the one doing revenge, him coming back from the grave functions in the exact same way. I would also argue that Hard Candy is a rape revenge
film.
Oh, absolutely
is.
Yeah, that one, it's a very, it's a different kind of one in the same way you're talking about by splitting who's actually getting the revenge.
Yeah, because she's not the victim of it, but I think that it still functions.
It's a super effective film, too. Like, it really pulls you in and switches. If people haven't seen that, I actually recommend it as a movie in general.
I think that's the most powerful aspect of these type of films is that like I've seen Hard Candy twice. I saw when it first came out and affected me so deeply, and then I caught it on cable again and I got sucked in because it's a very well made executed movie. And that's the thing, even though this is my least favorite subgenre of horror, I'll never forget I Spit on Your Grave. I can I can clearly remember. It's these are the type of films that just stick with you.
I've seen it once. I've seen Irreversible once. I've seen Fat Girl once.
You don't think you're necessarily meant to rewatch some of these.
Yeah,
you
and you're not supposed to. You don't have to like I do because for me, like it is a personal therapeutic release. Like I find a lot of catharsis in them, but I understand that that's not for everybody. Like I don't shame people who can't watch it because they're not meant for everybody. But just because it's not meant for everybody doesn't mean it's not meant for somebody.
Mm-hmm. The foreign version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is super effective. She's one of the books are one of the most effective characters
Elric.
I've ever read.
We're so alike.
But then I saw the American one, I was like, it's okay. And I don't know what it would have been like had I not seen the foreign, but the foreign one was so alive with that character. And that's the original translation of those books is Men Who Hate Women. And not Girl with Dragon Tattoo. They were literally called The Men Who Hate Woman. And you're like, man, that is like powerful in your face. Like, here it is. This is what we're talking about, you know? But also an entertaining character. And she's complex and she still enjoys sex. And she still does things that might surprise people about that kind of victim character.
And that's what we need more of. Like, I think if there's going to be rape revenge films for the new millennium, that's what it's going to be. Is it's not going to be necessarily people that are, you know, now these like bloodthirsty vigilantes. It's going to be people who are getting their justice in the way that they can and still living a normal life.
I also think that something that we'll see in the new millennium, at least I hope so, is that the perpetrators will stop being these crazy redneck hillbillies in the woods or these like crazy, you know, madmen, homeless men, that it's going to be the person that she's known forever or the person that she's seen every single day for the past 10 years. It's going to be much more reality than like the mysterious monster lurking in the shadows of the alley.
I think it'll always simmer in the home video market, you know, that kind of thing. Cause it's a lazy go-to.
Right. Yeah. You know? Well, cause nobody wants to accept that. I think the last time I checked, it was 83% of all rapes like are by somebody that they know. Yeah. And nobody wants to put that on screen because it's not fun. Like, you want to be able to have a bad guy. You don't want to have, you know, the drunk friend who, you know, didn't understand what they were doing. Like, you don't want to walk that line. And I'm also, like, since seeing these films and, like, kind of studying them, like, I've very much become anti, like, burn people at the stake because in America especially, like, our sexual politics are so fucked up, and there are people that legitimately don't understand what they're doing, that don't realize what they've done is like such a violation. And most people look at it and like, oh, it's common sense. Like, how do you not know that? It's like, well, some people don't. Some people don't get it because they have that kind of like boys will be boys mentality. Like, you even have looking at Carrie when like her mom is telling her about the period, she's like, boys or dogs are gonna come sniffing after that blood. And it's like, you, when you perpetuate that idea, then you look at these films like there's even a scene in I Spit in Your Grave where Johnny is talking to Jennifer and he's like, you come into our town, the city girl, and you've got these long legs and you're real pretty. And like, what did you expect? And it's like, well, people have that mentality. And like, that's so fucked. But in
the leader
order
of your country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And seriously. I use your in these circumstances because it's the only chance I get. No, but because it, literally those words we used when he did that comment, people said boys will be boys locker room talk. And you're like, no, I'm sorry. That's a little, it's different. I've been in locker rooms with a lot of boys. I've never even heard that bad. Like, not even as bad
as that. Exactly. And
so,
you have to we have to break apart that mindset before we can ever make progress in like ending it. Because right now when you just like immediately demonize people without really understanding, okay, well, why did you do this? What is making you feel like this is something that you mm-hmm. need to do? Like whereas rape revenge movies now are like these, you know, are people in the alley monsters. When you do that, then you're just painting everything as a monster and you're not understanding. And when you don't understand, you can't fix it.
And living in New York City for 10 years, I can say it's you would be hard pressed to find a woman there who has not had something completely horrible screamed at her or yelled or even just completely inappropriate said by somebody as they were passing by. And as much as I like to think that people know otherwise, there seemed to be just as much a culture that found that acceptable there. Mm-hmm. And it's really bizarre. And I'd never seen it anywhere else. And it wasn't until one day that my husband was like walking like significantly behind me that he was like, that guy just said that to you. Are you just like just walking on by? And I'm like, yeah, it happens all the time. Yeah. You just kind of keep going. And
yeah, Chicago is the same way.
Yeah. And it's weird to think that, you know, that there is some type of culture that still thinks that that's acceptable, but it's pervasive.
And now it's moved to the internet mm-hmm. Because I can't go a single day without somebody either tweeting at me or messaging me or saying something disgusting like, is your name BJ because you earned it? And it's like, what? Come on, grow up.
Right. I used to post them and then I got really sick of doing that. And I was like, this isn't even, it's not even changing the world. So why am I doing it? Like when I'd get like just tweets from random person saying like, are you into BDSM? Well, what? Why would I even? It's just yeah. who
just
thinks
forward
that's
those posts
okay.
to us.
I have.
Give
I
us
have
all
a,
those
I
posts.
Used to have a file of.
I
dick
do.
Pics.
You do. I have okay. a folder of oh unsolicited dick pics and like weird stuff people have sent me on Twitter. And like just for shits and gigs, I downloaded that Saraha app that everyone's been doing where you can send anonymous messages. And like half of it is really awesome and inspiring. The other half is disgusting.
Wow.
And they're hilarious because I'm at the point now where I just find it funny. When I first started writing, I had a big problem with it because I was 18 and there's still that like, oh, barely legal kind of thing. And people that, you know, I now have known for 10 years have apologized. They're like, I was super gross to you 10 years ago. I'm really sorry. It's like, well, I'm glad you figured that out now. But I'm very worried about like the generation of like girls with the internet and all the gross stuff that comes with it. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that people start to seek out rape revenge films, but allow themselves to be exposed to it because I think that there is a lot of learning that can be done from watching these films.
And you had suggested earlier in the show that 18 might be that moment, but I actually think it should
be
sooner.
It's gotta
because
be younger.
By 18, they're already like kind of wired in a certain way.
Oh, if you think that the
14, they're already wired.
Absolutely.
It's
like,
insane. It's insane.
Yeah.
And I mean, and we're maturing earlier and earlier and earlier. Like there are girls that are like menstruating as early as 9. Like they are able to have children at 10 years old. Like that's the world we live in. And you have to accept that and prepare for it and understand that like even like children even have sexuality. And when they're toddlers, they don't know that it's sexual. They just know it feels good. So when they get older and start to learn like what that means, like that's when you have to like dive in and do it. And a lot of people freak out when they're like, you watch I Spit in Your Grave when you were 15. Like that's extreme. I'm like, yeah, but that is why I am the way that I am, because I was exposed to that so early and I was forced to kind of learn and grow up so quickly. But that it's become like a pivotal like film in my life. Like that film is just as impactful in who I am as a person as like Fright Night, which is something that's way more fun. And there's nothing wrong with having such wildly different movies be that impactful.
Well, some people might be listening to who listen to our normal episodes who just want hard talk and think, okay, well, this was cool at start, but they went off topic and made it all serious. But what I really like about what you're saying is like what this is really about is the power of a movie as well, a power of one exactly. movie. We're really coming back down to not just the rape revenge, but one movie's power, which happened to be a horror film for one person being you. Is to me is like the whole point of this show and always was for us, like that we remember these feelings we had being young kids watching something. It's the only reason we're all sitting here, right?
Yeah.
And so I kind of think there is something to that beyond just, you know, victims and the really awful parts of this, there's, I don't want to say beautiful part to it, but there kind of is that something can get people through shit And you're not the only one, right? We know a lot of our friends, a lot of people online that we all know have written very brave things about a movie being part of how they survived life, which I think is really empowering, you know?
Well, I think that's a good way to wrap it up. Yeah. I mean, like, it really is. I mean, it really boils down to filmmaking, you know, and story.
The
power of cinema, exactly.
And intent. Because this is where the word exploitation perhaps is wrongly used.
Right.
If somebody is trying to exploit something, it's exploitation. Like Roger Corman knows that he is going to make money by doing X, Y, and Z equals, oh, that's a good idea then. And that's a good thing. And exploitation can be fine. I don't think that's a problem. But when we exploit something like this, it's a strange category.
It is.
But,
well, BJ, thanks for coming on and talking.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Thank we'll have you back so much for hopefully slightly cheerier topic next time.
What would be the other topic? If it wasn't that, what would you choose?
Chris Sarandon filmography.
Oh, my God.
Just Sarandon exploitation.
I can just talk about Chris Sarandon movies forever.
You do know that he was meant to be the star of Possession. He actually was originally cast.
Are you serious?
When it went to sales market, it was a Johnny and Chris Sarandon. I've seen one sheet about it.
I like that Shockwaves is
the drinking
is
game.
Basically not a drinking game, but Possession trivia. every episode,
we're better than
someone
Wikipedia.
Gets a little nugget.
I didn't know that. I've got a show with this guy for 20 episodes.
That's what I'm saying. Is like every episode, it's like, oh my God, I can't wait for next week. Because what the fuck is that going to bring to the table?
I only knew that because like I'm that obsessed with Chris Sarandon. Like I don't care how old he is. Like, yes, I'm down immediately.
All right.
Well, he's a big listener, so that'll be cool. Send your
totally going to message you now.
Give me your 76-year-old dick pic.
Oh, God. On that note, we'll be back next week. Don't forget to check us out on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Don't forget to leave us a star review on iTunes.
Yes.
And don't forget to review us.
#76 dick pic.